be spectacle, there'll be fantasy, there'll be daring do and stuff like you would never see.
Hey, an actor!
Yeah, we're gonna be a movie
starring everybody
and me. There'll be heroes bold, there'll be comedy, and a lot of fun setting for us to happily.
Hey, an actor!
We can watch it on the valley
starring everybody!
And Zoe Saldana. Hello, and welcome to Hey An Actor, the show where the brothers Wilson talk about actors and what they do and ting. I'm Pandy, as always, and I'm joined, as always, by my as-always brother, Ian Always. How are you, bro?
Well, as always, brother, I'm here.
Oh, good.
I'm okay.
Yeah. I gather you're a bit burned out with all the comedy that you've been doing recently.
Well, just... I was telling so many jokes.
Wearing red costumes.
Because I did start off last year, but I've become a bit more theatrical this calendar year, having worn a Phantom of the Opera mask for Mabel's palsy.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also wore a Carnival Barker outfit to promote a show.
Mm-hmm.
And then my last few outings, I've been wearing a breadhead, which I did buy again to promote a show. But because I've actually got it now, I thought, what better thing to wear when delivering a series of bread puns in a national competition?
Yeah.
than a massive bread. So, yeah.
There you go.
So that's my life.
Did you talk about the film Yeast is Yeast?
Hey! Well, for Jimmy Mystery Month, by all means.
Or did they not like it and they told you to catch you off?
That's not one of the ones I used.
Never mind.
Hey, brother.
Yeah.
How is the profession in which you work?
Oh, it's going all right. It's busy times right now. I am on site pretty much every day, and I cycle to work, so my legs are very tired, and my feet are starting to ache as well, which is not good when I've got another half marathon this year, but that's by the by. I'll cross that bridge when I come to it, possibly on a wheelchair. But yes.
Well, you're not meant to cycle a marathon.
You're not, no, but you do use the same appendages.
That is true.
Yeah, just in a slightly different way. Less metal between your thighs. But yeah, busy, as is life. So we're here again to continue our podcasting Funtime Charlies, and we are talking about another amazing, acclaimed actor this month. We are talking about the fantastic Zoe Saldana! /Saldana.
The highest grossing box office actor of all time to date.
Of all time. Which is pretty cool, but which makes sense. And we'll talk more about her filmography at large later on. But she's been in some very high-profile things, which have made a big ton of money. But still, I would say, is not like a household name.
I'm not so sure I'd say that. I think she's probably a household name, but I think she's probably not within... If you didn't know the fact that she was the highest-grossing actor in Hollywood... I think people would throw out at least 30 names before they think of Zoe Saldana.
Yeah, if you went on Pointless, the TV with very low answers equal good points. I don't think it would be a pointless answer, but you're right. People would pick other people ahead of her.
It would be a low answer.
It would be a low one, yeah. Mm. Mm. So we're talking about Zoe Saldana and her film.
We're kind of avoiding the franchises.
We are.
So it'll be interesting going over the three films that we've picked out for this very episode.
Indeed. Of course, we've covered her in a few films before.
We have, yeah.
We'll cover that a little bit later on. We're going to finish today's episode with her most recent of the three films, that being the Oscar award-winning Emilia Perez.
Indeed.
Before that, we'll be talking about Funtime Charlie, Cat Blue Smurf Pocahontas film Avatar. But we're going to start, brother, with the very first of our three films, that being a, shall we say, ill-fated biopic? Or maybe we'll talk about...
You know how much we love doing biopics.
Oh, we love biopics.
Let's get ready for some sink ripping.
Here we go, as we talk about her playing Nina.
Black is the color of my true love's hue. Do you know who I am?
Yeah. My mother used to listen to you.
Nina Simone!
I want you to come with me. We'll pay you $2,000 a month. In return, you take care of all my affairs.
Plane leaves at 9 a.m. Ask your mama.
Will you get some champagne and bring it upstairs?
I brought you some food and your medication.
I didn't ask for any of that.
Complicated lady.
Tell him to get me my money!
Drinks, smokes, she's out of shape.
Want to go to the gym?
No.
What happened, Nina? Why are you playing in front of 100 people and not 20,000?
I'm tired.
No one wants to see her play the way she is now.
I will make it.
Yes, you will. I need you to help me make this happen.
I'll try.
I want to hear about Nina's comebacks.
She needs this.
I want to feel free.
You're astonishing.
This song kept us marching. Made me believe that we had a chance.
What is freedom to you?
I'll tell you what freedom means to me. No fear. If I can have that for half of my life, no fear, that's the only way that I can describe it.
Everyone thinks that you are crazy.
What does that have to do with playing music?
Nina is a 2016 biographical film, because, you know, we like to change things up every now and then here at Hey An Actor. About the legendary musician from the American country of America, Nina Simone. What a weird way of saying that, anyway. And it starts in the year 1988, a fine year indeed, where Nina Simone is a bit down on her luck, having gone through some things which the film keeps flashing back to every now and then throughout its runtime, where she eventually is admitted to a psychiatric hospital for a short stay and subsequently hires one of her nurses by the name of Clifton Henderson, played by David Oluwole, you have to excuse me, who then returns to her home in France and tries to make her more of a marketable musician again, to maybe potentially bring her star back to ascendance, to kind of help her confront some ghosts of the past. And what I didn't mention is that Nina Simone is played by Zoe Saldana, which is important to note. So it's a film that we kind of picked sort of unfairly, for two reasons. One, we've done lots of musical biography films, and it's kind of a running trope now. But two, it gained some criticism for various reasons, which I'm sure we'll get into later on. How much did you know about Nina going into it?
How much did I know about the person?
By which I mean, I know you're aware of Nina Simone as a person, but I guess my questions are, one, how much do you know about the artist Nina Simone?
Hmm.
And then how much do you know about this biographical film of her life?
Well, the two things kind of coalesce, because I first saw this around 2019.
Okay.
And it was because at the time, one of the podcasts on my rotation was something called Blood on the Tracks, which was a music kind of panel podcast hosted by Colin Murray.
Oh, that guy.
It has Linkin Park. I like that record.
It's Last Prophets.
Less on that one.
That was the era.
That is to say, the Northern Irish DJ and now host of Countdown, because that's how your career in the media progresses, obviously. And a lot of times, because ostensibly they're around saying, bring the song that you feel best encapsulates di-dum-di-dum-di-dum. And almost every episode, someone would pick a Nina Simone song.
Right.
And so that got me to thinking. I obviously know of Nina Simone songs. Put a Spell on You, Feeling Good, classics. Uh-huh. Stone Cold classics. What did I know about Nina Simone herself? Little. It's like,
right.
At best, I was aware that she had dabblings in the civil rights movement. And I remember, like, there's a song on the Watchmen movie soundtrack, because, and that soundtrack very much looks at the songs that are actually referenced by your neighbour, Alan Moore, in his creation of Watchmen. There's a link to a song in, I believe, each issue. And it's called Pirate Jenny, where it's a kind of cautionary tale about a woman who's very much abused in her community, but she doesn't mind because she's waiting for some pirate ships to arrive. And it turns out she is one of the pirates who's been separated. And as soon as the pirates invade, she gets to turn the tables and says, slaughter them all.
Oh, wonderful.
It's a lovely song for the children. So basically, I'm aware of how talented a vocal artist Nina Simone is. I knew very little about her history, which is why I thought, ha-ha, a Nina Simone biopic, this will tell me about her history. Now, here's the thing, brother. As you mentioned, we've been on a fair run of biopics of late. I mean, even Danny DeVito, it wasn't a biopic about one of his characters, but even so, we've just been on this long run of biopics. And so what's so pleasing about being able to cover Nina is we're talking about a biopic that eschews, that should be said, shuns the traditional idea of structure and very much decides to show little snippets of history without telling you basically anything about it, and focuses very much instead on the autumn to winter of her career when she's a washed-up has-been. And you know, and that's only a problem with the story and structure of the film. There are all sorts of problems, such as Saldana's casting. That's not to say that's not to necessarily say she was bad, and we'll go into that later. But moreover, for a woman who's had such a really colourful life, why ignore basically all of it and then just put in certain scenes that don't make sense? Heart-featured actor Richard Pryor makes an appearance. Why? Fuck knows. But
I miss that shit.
Yeah, I know. So, ultimately, I was kind of disappointed with it when I first saw it, and watching it again, I had all of those biopics we've watched within the last year or so in my mind going, wow, this is worse than I remember it being. it's also quite short. So, it clearly wasn't meant to be a warts and all telling, notwithstanding it looks at a particularly down period of Nina Simone's career. So that's my position. You, brother, watching it for the first time, what did you think of Nina?
Oh, thank you so much for bringing it to my attention. I mean, you basically hit the nail on the head there, really. It seems really unfair. And it's kind of, it's interesting in a way, I mean, we've seen enough biopics where it starts the story at a certain point of a character's career, and then they're looking back, or like events conspire, and then there's kind of harking back to previous moments that then inform this decision or whatever. when we did the, what's it called? Buddy. Oh,
Buddy.
What's
the... Dewey Cox? The
Dewey Cox story was
walk,
like
walk
that.
Hard. He...
Sorry?
Walk Hard.
Yeah, when we did Walk Hard, that was pastiched brilliantly before he did a performance, and there's the line about he can't perform until he's recapped every moment of his life up till now. And this is not quite the same thing, but it definitely starts in a place and then dips back into, like, he finds a tape, and then that goes back in time to when she's recording this tape, yeah. And this is what could have been, or this is what led to this being a thing, or whatever. But it's... I mean, there are a lot of problems with the film which maybe could be excused, but the setting or the tunnel of her life, if you came into this film knowing nothing at all about Nina Simone, it wants to paint her, or seemingly wants to paint her as in the most positive terms, a troubled artist who is, despite all of her foibles, still beloved when she returns back to her home country. At worst, a wash-up has-been who kind of spoiled her own career by being a bit of a dickhead and is kind of pulled kicking and screaming back into the limelight, or back to where she should be.
I mean, doing...
I've got a tablet on my my soft palate, which sounds like I've got a lisp.
I mean, having done a bit of research into Simone... In preparation for recording, Nina Simone was bipolar, so it's right. Very much explained why she had like mood swings and was difficult and temperamental. The film never uses that word.
Right.
The film at best says she needs medication. She's obviously an alcoholic, but apart from that, it's just a case of, you know, why is she so difficult? You know, it's never said. It's never explained. And there's no. So much opportunity to say it. Like, if this was in the hands of a gifted writer-director, which Cynthia Mort was not, I believe this was her directorial debut, and she right. has disowned the film because she was locked out of the editing process. So she reckons that her version would have been better. But even so, I doubt it would have been better cutting out everything that kind of better explained the reason for certain things. So they never really explain why, after threatening a lawyer with a gun, she can just walk out of a psych ward. Is it because she's a celebrity? Probably, it's America. But but it goes, as you say, there's a scene where Clifton plays a tape, and it's to do with... What did you think that scene was about, brother? Because I looked it up, but if you didn't look it up, you wouldn't have any fucking idea, I don't think. But
no, I mean,
humour me, what do you think that... Well, Clifton plays a tape, and it's going back to a recording that a younger Simone is doing with a friend of hers.
I mean, I have very little knowledge of Nina Simone's life,
sure.
Really, but I took that as like a sort of love line, as in this was somebody who was potentially a romantic partner.
Yeah.
How close am I?
I couldn't tell you for definite, but okay. The woman in herself was a playwright and civil rights activist called Lorraine Hansberry.
Right.
She wrote a play which wasn't completed by the time that she died. She was only like 34 when she died. But the song that Simone kind of plays, which is meant to be inspired by the play or has dealings with it, is called Young, Black and Gifted.
Yeah.
And so Simone had something to do with at least getting the song out after Hansberry's death. Would you have known any of that from this film?
Good Lord, no.
No. Okay.
No.
As I say, there's a cameo from Richard Pryor. not the actual Richard Pryor.
No. He's long dead.
Yeah. Well, yes, there's that. it is Mike Epps from one of your favourite films, Madame Web.
Oh, good. That was a great film. What did he play in Madame Web?
The black guy.
The black... That's not his character
O'Neill.
I don't remember that.
O'Neill, according to Wikipedia...
One of the police...
Cassian Ben's co-worker and friend.
Oh, there you go. Worked for the police. Oh, no. Was it the police or I've not the seen the film, service? I don't know. I think it's the ambulance service. God, that's an awful film.
Either way...
We should do that, Phil. Anyway. Okay.
Well, for Dakota Johnson month. Yes. So, I mean, literally, she calls him having got her kind of cancer diagnosis. Like, is calling him for reassurance. And then the scene flashbacks to her giving him, as a young, nervous stand-up comedian, some reassurance. And that is the sum total of why Richard Pryor is in the film.
Are we basically saying, I mean, we've not really talked about Zoe Saldana yet, but the main problem with this film is its direction. Well, direction and writing. It's a flawed project from the off.
The story and how it's written. I don't think it's got... I mean, we can lambast biopics for... being somewhat formulaic, notwithstanding sinks being ripped out of walls and everything. but I think it's one thing to try and subvert the formula. It's another to basically not say necessarily anything about the subject in question. No. Like just raising like more questions than it does. Like making you more confused about the subject after having seen the film than before you went in to see it. I think that's an issue.
I think you've hit the nail on the head there. And I think this film really expects the people watching it to know who Nina Simone is and everything about their life. And just for them to kind of go, oh yes, wasn't it sad at the end of her life? But thank goodness she made it through that storm. Because she's lovely. If this is meant to be like baby's first Nina Simone, it's a shocking failure.
Mm.
If it's meant to be something for the fans, it fails.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
And so I think before we talk about Zoe Saldana, Cynthia Moore is the reason why this film fails for the most part.
Well, insofar that she's the director and the writer.
Yeah. Indeed. So... let's transition into Nina Simone herself, as played by Zoe.
Yes.
Because she's on a bit of a hiding to nothing. I mean, you mentioned about the casting of her as a person, and I'm aware that this could get a little bit awkward, us being two white British blokes, but the main criticism comes from her being an African-American Latino actress, Latina, playing... somebody who is a lot more dark-skinned than herself.
Yes.
And not really having the same backgrounds, than just kind of going, well, she's sort of black and she's a good actress, so she'll do. To be quite flippant about it.
Yeah, I mean, she wasn't the first choice.
Okay.
It was originally going to be Mary J. Blige. It was the case that Simone had a daughter who is... referenced in passing over the course of the film, but they never it never really goes into the hows and whys. And Simone's daughter says that my mother was raised at a time when she was told her nose was too wide and her skin was too dark. Appearance-wise, this is not the best choice. Now, it should be said that Simone Kelly, as is her name, didn't have a problem with Saldana per se. It was just that it was seemingly her being miscast, because not only is she not perhaps a look-alike of Nina Simone in her prime, because this came out in 2016. So Saldana at that time wasn't even, I tell a lie. So she would have been 38 years old. But the majority of the film is taking place in the 80s, 90s, really the 90s. And in 1995, Simone was 62.
Yeah.
And yet it's still portraying her as being sexually active, which is fine. Ladies.
Overtly promiscuously.
Sure. And, you know, not being, you know, the most stable of people. But also, it's calling for Saldana to overemphasize her skin color. That there have been suggestions through the reception of Saldana having to, the word blackface has been used, which is unfair, but has had to use darker makeup and prosthetics and wigs, just to visually portray her before you even get to the fact that for the most part, she's portraying Simone as being 25 years older than she actually is, which, you know, is a thing that the actors have to do. It's just a tall order. And you wonder whether, say, it could have gone to someone else. I mean, for example, we've covered Viola Davis. As a previous hard subject, are you telling me that she couldn't have taken on that role? As someone a bit older?
True, but then the conversation might shift to, would she want to have come onto this film? Could she see that this was going to be a failure from the off?
Well, there is that. I mean, it could be that she passed on the role. And one thing that I would say about Saldana is she does do all her own singing. I did check through the credits. Every song... It's not a kind of what's love got to do with it situation where it's like Tina Turner doing the actual singing and Angela Bassett miming. It is a case of Saldana doing the song. And again, I'm not a connoisseur of Nina Simone films. I think she does a good likeness. I don't know if it's necessarily akin to what Whackin' Bottom was doing with Johnny Cash. But I thought she applied herself to the role as best she could. I just don't think she was necessarily well cast. And you know who agrees with that? Zoe Saldana.
Aha!
Who initially defended taking on the role, but then said, I should never have played Nina. I should have done everything in my power with the leverage that I had 10 years ago. A different leverage, but it was leverage nonetheless. I should have tried everything in my power to cast a black woman to play an exceptionally perfect black woman.
Fair enough.
So those are Saldana's own words.
This is 2016, by which point she's been in some blockbuster hits, so she should have had some heft to kind of throw around to try and make this a better project, or to, you know, to kind of bypass it completely because you knew it would be kind of a big old pile of poo.
Avatar. She was now in the Star Trek franchise. She had done one Guardians of Galaxy film at this point, so
which was a huge success.
So yeah, she was well on her way to, you know, her commercial prominence that we're going to go into, but I mean, yes, perhaps she could have thrown her weight around a bit more, but that didn't happen. The other cast member of note, apart from the fact that Clifton's dad is motherfucking Keith David.
Oh yeah,
yeah. Are you a big fan of Keith David, brother?
I love Keith David. He's great.
What's your favourite Keith David thing?
I mean, he was great in Community. He was in a season of that.
Was he? Awesome.
Yeah. He was, I can't remember whether it was season 5 or 6. I think it was 6. But yeah, he was great in that. Because that was back under Dan Harmon.
Yeah.
He's also really good in the... It sounds really churlish now. The first Call of Duty Modern Warfare game.
Oh, wow, okay.
He's like the... there was a really old classic meme back then where, like, he'd be the one to give your character Ramirez a task to do. And he'd be like, Ramirez, go over there and clear these people. And the meme was that it would get increasingly more ridiculous for one soldier to do that. Ramirez, go and take over China. Ramirez, go to the moon. Yeah, so you would hear his voice a lot.
Okay, cool. For my part, film-wise, he's in two very renowned John Carpenter films from the 80s, The Thing and They Live. And do you remember, brother, the somewhat dark Disney cartoon Gargoyles?
I do.
He was the main character Goliath.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember it being a thing more than actual stuff about it.
As well as on a Disney bent, he was also Dr. Facilier in The Princess and the Frog.
Yes, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's got actually the best song in the film, I think.
Oh,
I got hoodoo, I got hoodoo, I got things you ain't even tried, and I've got friends on
I have not seen that film in its entirety, but I've rewatched that song multiple times.
Yeah. It's not a great film.
I mean, but, sure, you know.
Yeah. Get the kids happy for a few hours.
So yeah, Keith David was an unexpected highlight. Should have been used more. But the other person...
her manager's dad was more of a part in her life.
Yeah, exactly. Unfortunately, we've got to suffer with the manager himself, which was David Oyelowo. Playing Clifton. He's quite famous now.
Is he really?
Yes. So he's a British actor who relocated to America just because there weren't a lot of roles for black actors going
up. Fair enough. He
was very prominent for playing Martin Luther King in the film Selma, which came out 2 years before. And
that's the biopic of Selma Blair, isn't it?
That's exactly right. Yes. So it shows his role in Legally Blonde and Hellboy.
I don't know. He didn't play Selma Blair.
No, just her manager.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, quite.
Yeah. He was also...
And Keith David plays his dad.
And the same year as Nina, he was also in a well-regarded film about a mixed race couple, which was a biopic with him opposite Rosamund Pike.
Oh, lovely. Your favourite Hole.
Indeed.
Hole person.
That's the one. He was also in The Help, which we covered. And he's one of the human villains in the Rise of the Planet of the Apes films.
Oh. So I don't think I've saw anything after the first reincarnation with James Franco.
That is exactly the film I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, no, I've not seen the
others. There's a few more of those.
Because I think Gary Oldman's in the next one. Also.
Yes, that's right.
Also, he was also in Spooks. And the BBC miniseries of Les Mis in 2018.
Yeah.
He played Javert!
That meme that I sent you yesterday.
It was some kind of lots of people's it's from Hairspray. Names from Hairspray.
Yes. I'm Becky. I'm Gina. I'm Tina. And I'm Javert. Do not forget my name.
You could do that with the Pink Windmill Kids as well, couldn't you?
Hi, my name's Katrina. Yeah. And my name's Javert.
Do not forget my opposite Dominic West as Jean Valjean.
Cool.
So there you go.
I started re-listening to that recently. It's a very good show.
Which show are we talking about?
Les Mis.
Oh, on Spotify.
Yes.
Yes, right. Okay. Yeah, because I've not seen this mini-series as such. Because
No, I haven't.
Because obviously it is a musical, but it's taken from
the actual... Victor Hugo
Victor Hugo book, which I'd be interested to read if I had time, which I do not.
You start humming along to the pages.
Oh, I say, this cast is rather splendid. Derek Jacobi is the bishop. David Bradley, Kel's old French teacher's husband.
Yes, well remembered.
He's in it. Olivia Colman is the landlady.
Okay.
And
grinding up mice and pretending it's beef.
That's
or whatever
the one.
It is.
Yep.
Yeah. Master of the house.
That's the one. Anyway, sorry, I was sidetracked.
Back from Clifton. French peasantry to Nina Simone.
What did you think about Clifton as a character? Because bland.
Bland, yes, I thought I said Brand. So what? No. Yes, Bland. I think you're right. This is not his strongest performance, I would say. But again, it might come down to how the character was written. Because I think... Is he... I'm going to botch this. Is it that they try to write him as gay? No, sorry. The actual character was gay, and they try to make him more sort of bisexual... Hence, having some sort of romantic relationship
Correct.
With Nina. Am I getting that right?
No, you are getting that right, yes.
Yeah. So they've kind of taken the original character and Hollywoodized him. And again, not wanting to kind of derail this review by going into other bits of media, but I rewatched a couple of episodes of Monkey Dust recently with the BBC Three animated show, and one of the sketch series was how Hollywood ruins various different stories. Hence why you get the Hollywood version of the Anne Frank story, where all the Jews are Irish people in a bar in the top of the Netherlands. Anyway, it's by the by. It made me think a lot of this kind of thing. The taking an original story and just go, it doesn't matter the actual accuracy of it. Let's just make him full-on bi, because it makes it more sense when there's a sort of romantic relationship rather than just being friends. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, he's certainly sympathetic, and he portrays being conflicted really well, as I'm sure the character or the real person would have been. Yes, it's a bit of a kind of role to kind of, come on, Nina, everyone knows you're a star, stop being such a wastrel and come and be a good singer again, because it's that simple.
Yeah. I don't know, it's just the fact that he takes a lot and they don't really explain why he's so patient.
Yeah. That's because he's a nurse.
Yeah, I mean...
It. That's kind of it.
Because that's their temperament. Because in your experience, nurses, always patient, every single one of them.
Every single one, aren't they lovely?
Absolutely.
I would like to read something out.
Okay.
So we talked, I kind of put a heavy pitch in that Cynthia Mort was kind of one who sort of ruined this film, but it was on a bit of a hiding to nothing. Zoe Saldana does okay with what she's got to do, but she's kind of a bit OTT, and yes, she has to sing, blah, blah, blah. I do just want to read this out, because in May 2014... Cynthia Mort sued the production company for breach of her director's deal, and ultimately said that she didn't have the final rights over the script, the cast, the crew, the editing,
right.
And so on. And as a result, she's claiming that the final film doesn't reflect her vision of Simone as a woman, musician, and civil rights activist.
Correct, yes.
So, I... Unless there were some really, really savage edits to remove a lot of what she put in to make it more overt, I think that's possibly her trying to...
Distance herself from it.
Distance herself or try and explain, no, if I had what I really wanted to do, it would have been a much better film.
Mm.
It seems like everyone has sort of disowned this project.
At the same time, she didn't like Alan Smithy herself.
But, no.
Although, no. I think I've heard somewhere that you can't do that anymore.
Oh. Okay.
I swear, it's like something like Richard Osman popped up with and everyone just accepted it's probably true because Richard Osman said it.
But, smart and tall.
Sure. Anything else? Because I don't think there's a lot more to say.
No, I didn't like this film. It's a badly made film.
It's a shame because Saldana does apply herself, but it's just a case of being miscast. It's like, you can see the appeal of taking on a very, because usually this kind of thing's Oscar bait.
But, absolutely.
This one, no, the critics hated it. It doesn't say what the budget was, but in terms of box office, it made 22.5 grand. Not million. $22,584
So, but $4 are really important to
absolutely,
note.
Absolutely, yeah.
That's the cost of a bucket of popcorn.
Yeah.
Oh dear, swing and a miss.
Never.
Which is a massive shame because Nina Simone's pretty cool, and I don't know much about her music, but indeed her life. If anything, one of the strengths of this film is that everyone can look at it and go, "That's not Nina Simone."
yes.
And to that end, okay, fine. It's told everyone who Nina Simone is by kind of eliminating certain parts that are actively wrong. It then uses her music, and Zoe Saldana sings well. If they had focused more on the music, and that's not to say they don't have a lot of her music all the way through. It's just not particularly well told. I don't think it's lazy. It's just bad.
What I would perhaps suggest instead then is to point out two documentary features about Nina Simone.
Okay.
There was one that was called What Happened, Miss Simone, which was produced in cooperation with Simone's estate and her daughter.
Right.
And it was nominated for the 2016 Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature.
Oh, no. The same year the same this year. Film came
yeah,
out.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
I have a feeling that the more, because of her directorial and the lawsuits around it, that actually delayed the release. So she might not actually have done, say, Guardians of the Galaxy prior to this.
Right.
So there was that, and then around the similar time, the year before, was The Amazing Nina Simone, an independent
with Andrew Garfield.
Written and directed by Jeff L. Lieberman, who initially consulted with Simone's daughter before going the independent route and working closely with Simone's siblings instead.
Okay.
Yeah, no Oscar nods for that one. And seemingly no Andrew Garfield, but never mind.
Okay.
Onwards.
Yes, next. Let's move on to our next film for this episode, brother.
Mm.
That being our second film today. The largest film that we've ever covered on this podcast, 2009's Avatar.
You Jake Sully?
I'd like to talk to you about a fresh start on a new world. You'd be making a difference.
I became a Marine for the hardship. I told myself I can pass any test a man can pass. All I ever wanted was a single thing worth fighting for.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are not in Kansas anymore. You are on Pandora.
You should see your faces.
We have an indigenous population called the Na'vi. They are very hard to kill.
This is why we're here.
Because this little gray rock sells for 20 million a kilo.
Their village happens to be resting on the richest deposit, and they need to relocate.
Those savages are threatening our whole operation. We're on the brink of war, and you're supposed to be finding a diplomatic solution.
The concept is to drive these remotely controlled bodies called avatars. They're grown from human DNA mixed with DNA of the natives.
Marine in an avatar body. That's a potent mix.
You get me what I need, I'll see to it you get your legs, babe. Your real legs.
Hell yeah, sir.
Looks like you. This is your avatar.
What
Just relax and let your mind go blank. It shouldn't be hard for you.
Jake, it's real simple.
I want you to learn from the inside. I want you to gain their trust.
You should not be here. Go back. All this is your fault.
I need your help. Outstanding.
Haven't gotten lost in the woods, have you?
Did you forget what team you're playing for?
Strong prey on the weak, and nobody does a thing.
You got 1 hour.
You knew this would happen?
Everything changed. Jake, it's crazy here. Quaritch is rolling, and there's no stopping him.
We're going up against gunships with bows and arrows.
Well, I guess we better stop him.
Us a message that they can take whatever they want, but we will send them a message that this is our land.
Dances with Wolves is oh wait, sorry. Fern Gully! No, that's not right.
Strike two.
The Smurfs is a 2009 epic science.
You're getting closer and closer.
Avatar! The Last Airbender is a 2009. All right. It's Avatar!
Yay.
The 2009 James Cameron film starring Sam Worthington, Zoe Saldana, Stephen Lang, Michelle Rodriguez, well, there's one, and Sigourney Weaver.
Sighorn! Well.
Indeed. And Avatar is the long told story, but with a James Cameron twist, of how Pandora, a habitable moon, has the valuable mineral Unobtainium.
The MacGuffin.
Deary me. which is, and basically the moon is being kind of mined, or they want to mine it a bit more than they're currently mining it, because the moon is inhabited by the Na'vi, who are 10 foot tall, blue skinned humanoids.
Cat things.
And to better connect with the Na'vi, the humans who are on Pandora, through the wonders of science, are basically put into hologram-like bodies so that they too can become Na'vi and work with them. So that is largely done by Dr. Grace Augustine, and had been done by the protagonist's identical twin brother, but he died. So the other twin, who is a paraplegic, is instead given kind of new life. Or is that an ableist thing to say? I don't know. He's basically able to walk again as a Na'vi. And as the humans want to drill in more and
drill, baby, drill.
Get to a rich deposit of unobtainium under the Great Deku Tree. it means that Jake has to inveigle his way into the tribe, where he grows closer with the Princess Pocahontas, or Neytiri. He's got to basically decide who he's with, the evil humans or the Na'vi. Mm. And, yes, that is the very derivative Avatar.
Listen, which, with your heart, you will understand.
I didn't watch at the time as a point of principle.
Oh, really?
Because, now obviously, famously, Avatar is one of the most financially successful films of all time. Now, I would say that you could only watch Avatar if you watched it as part of the 3D boom around that time, so tickets were inevitably more expensive, therefore, inevitably, it's going to gross more at the box office, isn't it?
I guess.
So there we go. I call shenanigans on James Cameron. also because James Cameron was so infused about how it was such a unique thing, particularly visually, and we can get to that, and saying, I don't think I'll be making more Hollywood films going forward for the rest of my career. I'll be going forward doing more Avatar films, in suggesting that loads of people wanted more Avatar films. That being said, that is a very accurate prediction of how his career has transpired since then. So I hadn't seen it before. I think I said on a previous episode, and this is the truth, I had caught like a bit towards the end of the villain death previously somewhere, but I hadn't sat down and watched the entire thing. So that is what I did for the benefit of this occasional podcast. and yeah, I can now finally say I have seen Avatar. And wow. I'll keep my powder dry. but, brother, you had seen it before at some point. When and what do you remember about it at the time?
I apparently was a massive corporate sellout and watched it in cinema. I assume I watched it in 3D, but yeah, I think you're right. It was a very much a kind of... I know it's come in waves, the 3D movie boom, and it's always kind of ebbed away pretty quickly, and I don't remember there being a massive benefit to it being in 3D, but I digress. I remember watching it at the time and coming out of it thinking, God, that was a pretty well done film. It looked pretty lovely. I think even at the time I could tell this is basically the Smurfs meets Pocahontas. And, you know, they're using a lot of kind of camera trickery and blah, blah, blah. But I didn't mind it as much because there was a kind of very good humanitarian story and a kind of nature story. And it was kind of, it was like a perfect popcorn film. You just go in and go, oh, baddies, they're the baddies and they're the goodies. And look how beautiful the goodie world is. Versus the bad world of the baddies with all their technology and stuff. How could they understand the subtleties of nature as I sat inside what was largely probably an air-conditioned cinema in a Western country? I remember watching it at the time and kind of enjoying it. I then kind of forgot about it as it then became like a massive box office thing, highest grossing thing in the world, and then a massive gap between Avatar films. And then kind of thought, well, why bother? Because, you know, it was good, but it wasn't that good. So I kind of went into watching it again with a view of, like, I probably missed something, didn't I? It probably was pretty bad. I was probably just suckered in by the spectacle of the thing. And I don't think it's bad. I think it's just a little bit lazy in terms of story, outweighed by the spectacle of the thing in a James Cameron movie. So, I'll set my stall out there. Let's not keep your powder any more dry. Let's wet that powder, or light it indeed. Brother, what did you think about Avatar?
Meh. Massive meh.
Massive meh. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I will admit the blinkers were slightly on. Because of everything.
Never you.
I know. I try not to. But the thing is, there's a certain amount of pomposity that goes hand in hand with James Cameron. Mm. And so it's a case of, okay, you're really going to have to impress me. And the idea was that I think he was going all in on the visuals to make Avatar.
Absolutely. Well, demonstrably, because he kind of had the idea of the film ages ago and went, no, the technology ain't there yet. So let's just park it, because he's pretentious and kind of feels, yes, I definitely will still be relevant. And like you said earlier, he's proved to be true. And that's come out again as part of the sequels, but we'll talk more about them a little bit later on. But sorry, I interrupted. Please continue.
I mean, this is the first film he made since Titanic.
Mm.
Titanic was in 1997. This was 12 years later. And he spent, like, all of those 12 years... When he wasn't under the sea looking for the actual Titanic. Like, working on this. And you think, for 12 years, there's got to be something pretty special at the end of it.
Well, and okay.
I don't think...
You don't think that's 12 years worth of work?
No.
Okay.
I can understand the amount of time that would have been done to work on the graphics and the visuals.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
obviously,
definitely.
None of it's half finished. This isn't The Mummy Returns. but
hey, don't you dare. Don't you dare.
What? They had half finished graphics. Just look at how Imhotep dies.
They wanted it to look shonky as fuck.
Well, mission accomplished. But I think the bigger thing, and I think this is also kind of to do with a question. It's not an original question, but if you think about how big it was at the time, how much money it grossed, because you can't argue with the box office, even if I've stated why I think it was probably rather inflated. I mean, still, people went to see it. You know, you can't get those numbers for nothing. And so it was obviously hugely successful. But riddle me this, brother.
Mm-hmm.
What cultural impact has it had since, apart from spawning a few sequels?
Well, everyone now knows that nature is important, and we shouldn't be greedy as humans. And that's
We've
why
got
Donald
David
Trump
Attenborough
wasn't elected.
For that. Next.
I mean, you're right, yeah. What did it add to the world? I don't know.
Are there any famous quotes of people, wearing T-shirts with Na'vi on them?
Jake Sully, you are so stupid.
Right.
Turukto, I don't know. No, not really. I mean, I was really, on kind of that bent, I was really surprised when they announced the sequels, as I mentioned earlier, and B, when they said, and Disney have just invested lots and lots of money in a Pandora-themed area of Disneyland.
Right.
Really? Is there, like, the call for that? Is it... I don't remember... And this speaks to your wider point. I don't know of many people who have, like, Avatar and all of its kind of sequels and so on as being, like, their favourite franchise or, like, a really important thing, which is really odd given that it is the highest grossing film of all time, apparently. I don't know whether it's just the kind of small sphere of influence that I'm party to. I do know of one person that I work with who is a massive Avatar fan, but even
really?
Then, that's... Yeah, but even then, it's not like that's their, like, favourite thing ever. They won't watch anything else. It's just a case of like, oh, yeah, I really like the Avatar films. Yeah, I might watch it again. But they also enjoy Harry Potter, so, you know, there's all sorts of things. All sorts of things wrong with their media output. But it's like... Yeah. I don't think you can dispute... I don't think anyone can look at Avatar and say that's a bad film. I would take a lot of issue with that. I think you could call it derivative. I think you could call it bombastic. But, you know, it's a Hollywood blockbuster. It's not a Hollywood blockbuster, but it's a massive film.
I think it is. I think there's an argument for that, yeah.
Sure. I think it's a really, really, really... good-looking film, well-made film, with a message which has been told before. Was it worth? I mean, clearly it was worth, but you know, is it really worth almost $3 billion? There's a bit of a disconnect there for me.
I mean, put it this way. I mean, again, I said meh rather than crap. You know, I didn't think it would. If we're going to take everything in as a whole, you can say it stands out because of its visuals.
Sure.
I'm not saying everything else was shonky. It's like all of the characterization. I mean, it was hit and miss, I think. Yeah. We'll get to that in a moment when we talk about the acting. But it's undoubtedly a well-crafted, visually stylistic film. And yes, a lot of money went into it. It generated a lot of money. That is, you know, basically a James Cameron film nowadays.
Yeah.
Nowadays.
It's an Avatar film. Of course it's a James Cameron film nowadays.
Throughout his filmography then. But again, it just comes back to, for such a successful film, I'm surprised it isn't more well-loved or has as much kind of cultural impact as James Cameron perhaps pretends it does have.
Hmm.
I think that's where I fall with regards to Avatar.
Yeah, no, I can go with that, absolutely.
Yeah. And then also, because it's not a particularly starry cast, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but, you know, Sam Worthington?
I mean, he had been in Clash of the Titans, had he, by this point? Or was that afterwards?
That was just afterwards.
That was just, same year as Terminator Salvation. I've just had a quick look. So, you know, the difference between those two films is striking. But, I think you're right.
I don't mind a newcomer, you know, playing a part or anything, but especially because I suppose for half the role he is computer generated.
I mean, still acting within that capacity, still doing the motion capture side of things.
Oh, yeah.
So still
yeah.
actively there, yeah. As was Zoe Saldana, and hence why we're talking about it this month. And but before we get onto her, I mean, the biggest name in the cast is Sigourney Weaver. And she is kind of plastered very much towards the beginning. She's one of the big kind of emotional through points in the film to a point.
Yeah.
I'll talk more about her later on, but then she also returns for the sequels, which I have now watched.
Right.
More on that later.
Okay.
But yeah, they're kind of leaning into, they've got this film. And we've got Sigourney Weaver. Look, we've got Sigourney Weaver. Isn't it great? We've got Sigourney Weaver, you know, and she's great. Does she fill in like $3 billion worth of investment?
I think Weaver, in fact, because she worked with Cameron for Aliens.
Sure.
So she knows what to expect, and therefore, I suppose by this point, yeah, former Heart subject Sigourney Weaver, she's built up a very impressive career. I mean, she would have been 60 when this came out. So
okay.
she's by this point, she's had a long body of work in a variety of different genres. But with regard to this, I think it's more a case of needing a kind of figure to lend a certain amount of authority, a different kind of authority, because she doesn't initially take to Sully at all.
No, because he starts out as a bit of a baddie.
Well, he's a Marine, you know.
He's a Marine who is tapped to go and be a splinter agent, working with the scientists, but reporting back to the military.
Well, that's the thing, because, I mean, so you've got the scientists on one side with Sigourney Weaver and the guy from Dodgeball, and then you've got the RDA powers that be, which are Stephen Lang for the military side, and Michelle Rodriguez, and Giovanni Ribisi.
Yeah.
The guy who's in everything, and a Scientologist.
Oh, is it? That's a shame.
Yeah.
Never mind, eh?
Famously, he's one of the big ones.
Oh, not famous enough for me.
Yeah. But yes, he was Phoebe's brother in Friends.
That's where I know him from.
With Kitty Foreman from that 70s show.
Yeah.
What a relationship.
Very odd.
Yes.
But there we go.
And I suppose there's one of the other things that's slightly uncomfortable about, and again, why the film might be seen as a bit derivative, is that the Na'vi are largely played by actors of colour. So Zoe Saldana is the main one as Neytiri. Her parents are CCH Pounder, who is Amanda Waller from the DCAU.
Okay.
And you might remember her famously being burnt to death in Face Off.
I still haven't finished watching Face
Off. No. Well, you pause it at that point. Or mum did.
Yeah. It was dinner time and me and Claire got scared.
Yes, indeed. And then the father is Wes Studi, a.k.a. Sagat from Street Fighter.
Oh, cool.
So the a proper Native American actor.
Right.
So it's just fine. Like... Well, this is on the nose.
Thread again. Yeah.
This is on the nose.
Spirituality, okay.
Yes. But, I mean, in terms of the acting, so if we look at Zoe Saldana, because she's always a Na'vi throughout, unlike Sam Worthington and Sigourney Weaver, like, dipping between the two. Saldana is there doing... the physical motion capture work and obviously the vocals. Was she convincing as a Na'vi?
Saldana?
Yes.
Yes. I mean, she has thrown herself into this role in terms of it's a very physical CGI motion capture performance. I've not seen any kind of making of documentaries or anything to kind of see exactly how they took like facial feature or facial movements and then transcribed them into a program or anything like that. But in terms of like coming or putting across a, cause she's one of the Na'vi who was previously kind of educated or taught English by Sigourney Weaver's character in her avatar body. Which then there was a bit of a falling out, and therefore they're a bit hostile, so they're still allowed a little bit, blah, 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 blah. But she speaks English, hence why they don't really need to have the listen with your hearts, you will understand song in this film. Yeah. Again, more on that later. The role is one of the kind of the teacher turned love interest. Kind of ingratiating Jake Sully in the mysterious and wonderful world of Pandora and the spirituality and Mother Nature and blah, 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 blah. And to that end, she's not the featured character by a long chalk, but she is like the emotional through line for a lot of things going on. Like the antagonism felt towards Jake Sully as a kind of, as an avatar, as someone who's not... I mean, just imagine it. If there was like a cat that everyone knew was a cat, but they had kind of put the cat's mind into a human body and it was going, I want to find out more about your ways. You know, people wouldn't treat it like a person. They'd spurn it. Though this is maybe a cat's the wrong creature, but still a mongoose or a crocodile or something a little bit circumspect. Like a mongoose. What an interesting choice. I digress. She does well, and when she has to cry, you are very sad, and when she is happy, you are happy, and then they fall in love, and they are now mated for life, but he betrayed her! Ah! Oh, how very sad.
My brother has just been possessed by his son.
I'm so sorry. Yes. He kind of inhabited me via an avatar body. But yeah, I mean, her role is very necessary, and it needs to be a kind of strong performance to get across this idea of the Na'vi are skeptical, but she's also mystical in and kind of looked at, there's like a sign, a kind of weird floaty creature lands on him, and therefore there's a, ooh, Mother Nature likes this one, we must listen to Mother Nature, and therefore the script kind of continues on from there. But it's not an unconvincing performance. There is a lot of kind of nuance within this weirdly CGI body roll thing. So you could either credit Saldana or credit the CGI artists or a bit of both. I don't know, but I know that it looks good.
Well, there we go.
Yeah. What about you? What are your thoughts of Saldana as Nitiri?
Yeah, 6 out of 10. I think you went over the heft of it, really. The only thing I'd add is just the way she kind of explain, like, obviously as the viewpoint character, to better explain to the wider audience through Jake Sully the ways of the Na'vi, and how you attach your tail to something and there's your connection. So
yeah,
I did see some rather crude things on the internet after Avatar came out with regards to that.
Disgraceful.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, my. I mean, there's a bit of that in the third one, actually.
Is there now? Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, but otherwise, performances... I mean, Stephen Lang is very arch as the villain.
Yeah, he's an interesting one. I don't remember seeing him in anything else. Like ever.
He's been in this and that. I wonder if he's been in... I'll take a look just to see if we have covered anything he's been in. But he's rather arch.
Absolutely, yeah. He's kind of full on, I don't care about these savages. I just want you to get in there and exploit the shit out of them so we can take what's underneath their tree.
Unobtainium.
Yes.
Now that's lazy.
That's very lazy.
That's unobtainium.
There is its own... Unobtainium does have its own page on Wikipedia as it being used in other places. But, you know, give it another name. Like, I don't know, Smurferite.
Sure.
I don't know, it's a bad example. But still, yeah, I mean, he's you're absolutely right. He plays a very good, arch, very tough military badass man. He's got a great big scratch down his face. He gives a big old kind of marine speech about, you got it, you ladies, you're not in Canada anymore. Blah, blah, blah. I'm going to kick your ass, boy. Kind of performance. And yeah, he fits the role really well. I think, I'm not sure there's much nuance to him in this one. He's got just got to be the out and out bad guy, and he does a good job with that.
Yeah, a bit too much for me, but you know, it's what the role needs.
Yep.
I mean, I don't think Cameron's ever suffered from writing particularly deep and complex characters.
I do feel that Billy Zane in Titanic school of villainy.
I mean, and even in Titanic, he was at least basing like his characters on actual people, and I can at least appreciate him doing the research, because that is his mastermind subject, isn't it?
But yes.
Here it's just like, ooh, we need a commander of the security forces who doesn't care for the aliens on board this planet.
Doesn't value their wonderful spiritual ways. I mean, there is a very good point midway through the film where Sigourney Weaver's like, these people talk to the actual planet. This is fascinating. This is incredible. It's an interface between living beings and the natural world. It is laughed off in the most kind of derisive form. There is a really good element of trying to square away to what end people's spirituality and spiritual beliefs should be borne in mind when it comes to cold, hard cash. It's a very ham-fisted way of doing it. And it's an example that literally has a planet that they can talk to using their special tail hair things. But could you not see there's a lovely kind of environmentalist message to this film?
Oh, I could see it, brother, because it was hammered into my fucking face every other minute.
He is with A1 now.
Yeah.
Fine. But on that, the world of Pandora, the storytelling, the world building, the creatures and so on. What did you think of that? Is that 12 years worth of work for you? The different creatures, how they all intermingle with each other, the life. This is a very well-made world.
It's well conceived. I'm not entirely sure. Again, 12 years. I think that's a long... So what was that in gross point blank? It was something along the line. 12 years! Gah! It is. I don't know. I'm not going to put this all on the gap in production. I'm not necessarily convinced it is as layered and deep as it thinks it is.
I think that's entirely fair.
Do you?
No. I think it is wanting to be. An epic story. Okay, it wants to be an epic story. I think it is an epic story. It is an unoriginal epic story, but it is. It wants to show off what can happen with greedy people in a beautiful world, and I think it does that well. I think it's come up with some very interesting kind of innovative plants and animals and how the local people interact with them. It's very beautiful. There are a lot of moments where you just watch them all go, wow! And there's like glowy, sort of lichen-y, bioluminescent plants whilst they're walking. And there's great big lovely mushrooms they kind of walk between. And they kind of consummate their love in amongst the forest floor. And then the man comes and destroys it all. No! You don't understand the beauty of nature. I mean, I think for me, it does enough to kind of show off a beautiful world to make you kind of care about it. And that there's a lot of escapism in the idea of, like, imagine being able to, like, bond with an animal that you could, like, then fly or ride across. And then, and the kind of the story of the primitive people taking on the man and winning. It's surprisingly anti-American, I would argue, this film. The kind of the underdog kind of native people rising up against the big military complex.
Mm. I mean, America's not really specifically stated. I think the RDA...
No. It's just very heavily coded.
Okay, right. Fair enough. yes, it was made for $237 million, so a lot. And it's come back and made $2.924 billion.
Ta-da!
Yeah. I can picture James Cameron in a Dr. Evil scene, strangely.
We've not seen any sharks with laser beams on their heads, but very close. Which leads me on to talking about the sequel to this film.
Yes, please do.
Avatar The Way of Water, and then last year, Avatar Fire and Ash, which I have, whilst kind of waiting to get our dates together and so on, watched. And, you know, I kind of prefer the sequels. Largely because they are, again, they're not world-beating. It's still the same idea of the wonderful Na'vi, aren't they wonderful, and the man coming back to wanting to carry on stuff. But this time, Jake Sully has a family, and everyone's just after Jake Sully because they've got to take him down, and then everyone else will go down as well, and blah, blah, blah. But this time, it's at the seaside. so, you know, more of the same in that way. But there's less of the kind of... You know, whose side are you on? You know, you were born a human. Don't you want to be a human? Something we didn't touch on just now with our review is the kind of the inner nuance of Jake Sully's character, where I mean, there are these kind of diary pieces that he does all the way through where he explains how he feels about kind of being in and around. And it's kind of used as a narrative framework for the film to have a voiceover without actually being like a heavy-handed voiceover. It's then used against him later on as a plot point, but that's by the by. There isn't that in the other films because he's now made his decision, I have a functioning body and therefore I would like to do this now, please. And again, functioning body, I apologise, that's kind of more of an ableist term, but he's kind of clearly the character kind of misses the feeling of having use of his legs. And it's just this kind of quirk of fate that he was a Marine, lost the use of his limbs, and now is able to kind of put his mind into this kind of bioengineered version of another creature, which he just so happens to really like, and therefore he carries on. And there you go. In the second film and the third film, he's already in that body. There still kind of ties back to his previous life, hence why they're hunting him down. The main thing, it's not much of a spoiler because it's kind of put across in the first few minutes of the second film, is horrible Captain, what's his face? I forget his name.
Schwartz.
Yes. He made a backup of his brain and his mind before going into that battle. And it's that backup which is put into an avatar body. So when they come back to Pandora, he's now an avatar as well. Ooh. So now it's avatar versus avatar rather than avatar versus humans.
So Agent but also Smith humans. Has come back. Okay.
I knew what I had to do, but I just could not force myself to do it. It's just the one of him. But all of his military pals come back. That's by the by. It's also got that guy from Flight of the Conchords in it as a marine biologist.
Ooh.
Yeah. Anyway. But yeah, I do prefer the second and the third films. They are kind of slightly less derivative, but still quite derivative.
I suppose he will have had longer to have worked on the story. The story
is that he's kind of decided, I'm not going to make these films yet. I'm going to wait until the underwater camera trickery or camera technology that I want to use works.
Right.
And again, my friend who kind of knows about Avatar and really likes Avatar has said, about, he was not kind of content with the bubbles you could see, so they had to kind of create these special tanks which would then have things on the top that would stop the bubbles from bubbling. Okay, great. And to that end, you do get these lovely kind of long pieces of a CGI character riding a fictitious creature under the waves. It's all very beautiful and look, nature. But then the man comes and the man wants to kill Jake Sully because they want to take this special whale blubber which literally reverses aging.
You nearly had me sold on watching the sequels. I was gonna go with Sully and family go to the beach and find Agent Smith is back looking for whale blubber.
Fine. Do you remember that joke from Me, Myself and Irene where that joke from Me, Myself and Irene, the Jim Carrey film, where he's like with his kind of girlfriend come wife at the beginning of the film, and he's saying about her, if we were frozen on an ice floe, would you eat whale blubber for me? And she's like, yes, of course I would. And then she runs off with someone else. And says, but you said you'd eat whale blubber. Oh, I'll give her whale blubber, all right, just as soon as I free Willy. That's what you made me think of.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, here ends the Avatar review on a joke from a completely different film.
Involving a penis.
Yeah.
No penises in this film. Lots of nudity. No penises.
Ain't that the way?
2 stars. Where are the big blue Smurf wangs?
Well,
imagine seeing them in 3D at the time. Jesus Christ.
Yes.
Swinging from tree to tree.
Right, okay. Well, with that image, blah, blah, blah. We now...
Jake Sully, oh my word.
Well,
I'm now going to connect with nature.
Well,
And he fucks hugs a tree.
Let's move on to our featured presentation, which also has something to do with genitals, but in a different way. Here it is, the Oscar-winning Emilia Perez.
Are you English?
No, I'm not English. Why?
No, because you, you are pretty.
So? Does your client have a name?
He desires to remain anonymous. If you're not willing to accept, I don't think it's worth talking. Just cut to the chase. To listen is to accept.
Is a 2024 musical crime film starring the fabulous Zoe Saldana, also Carla Sofia Gascon, Selena Gomez, her from the Disney Channel, and many more. And it's all about an attorney played by Saldana herself, who is approached by some kind of crime kingpin, who has an interesting request for her, that being to facilitate a transition. She helps her out, and it follows what happens before the transition, during the transition, and the many events that happen after the transition as people try to carry on with some things in a world that is frowned upon or in a situation where they will not be able to do exactly what they want. I'm trying not to spoil things too much because it's a 2024 film. And equally, what is unable to go back to how things were before, and how the attorney played by Saldana is kind of trapped in a very odd situation. It's a film that, when it first came out, I was aware of because it had quite a lot of notoriety, which I'm sure we'll get into in a moment. That being its depiction of all sorts of things, including trans people in general and Mexico. And then it won an Oscar, and a lot of people were thinking, what? Really? So I was very interested to watch it, it being a reasonably contemporary film, very different to a lot of things we've done before, and we were able to watch this film together, brother.
We were, yes. And I think that helped.
Yes.
It's not the easiest film to follow. That's not to say there's a weird chronological narrative structure or anything like that. It's not like Memento, where everything's split up or anything. It was more a difficult film to follow because it starts off, okay, it's a foreign language film. Okay, it's a foreign language Musical film, okay. Interesting, haven't seen a lot of those. No. And then our protagonist gets kidnapped and suddenly, hoo-hoo, Mexican cartels. And then it takes a very unusual turn with regards to what the through line of the plot is. So
yes.
It's a film that tries to do a lot, and in trying to do that, it doesn't please a lot of people, but I think it's a case of, because it was such an ambitious project, it won a lot of awards, but it was not necessarily one of those critically beloved films at the same time.
No.
And I can understand why, because it's strange. But, yes, us watching it together certainly assisted.
Yeah. I mean, if for no other reason than when we finished watching it, I remember us having a bit of a kind of muted silence going, right, okay, so, yeah. And try to kind of piece together exactly how we felt about it, having watched it all, because there are, it's a weird mishmash of things that are really earnest, things that are actually quite moving and quite emotional and well told in a story way,
yeah.
But then also some batshit crazy things, especially the very end of the film.
Yes.
And then you've got these songs all the way through, and I remember asking you, brother, what did the films bring to this film? Or did the film really need those songs? And I think I've answered the question. What do you think about the songs, first and foremost?
Some were absolutely hilarious. the songs about surgery, for example.
Yes.
Like singing them halfway through the film when they had no proper context.
Penis or vagina, penis or vagina.
Yeah.
It makes it sound like I'm being flippant. It's as flippant as that.
Well, quite. Because it's quite jarring overall. I mean, put it this way. Our musical crime films to date are... Chicago,
right,
and Bugsy Malone. And this ain't like either of those, brother.
No, not really. I don't remember Bugsy Malone singing about people's smells.
That was a great one, wasn't it?
Now, on that, I have a game for you, brother. Do you want to play it now?
Okay,
so in the film there is quite a touching moment where Emilia Perez's son, who mistakes Emilia Perez for his aunt.
Well,
that's the explanation given to him about, yes.
Yes.
Notices that actually she smells like his dad, which of course was definitely the case, or is still definitely the case, but... In the song that comes afterwards, he explains or sings about all the different things that her dad smells like. So the question is, what does Emilia smell like? This is a true or false game, brother. I'm going to ask you some questions. You're going to say true or false. Is this what Emilia smells like? Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay, number one, sweat.
No.
Yes, Emilia smells like sweat.
Which is,
and that's
which
what reminds
you think
him of,
was correct,
of his dad.
But, yeah.
Mm. Number two, lamb roasting over a fire.
True.
It's true. Yes. You can smell of sweat that. And lamb roasting over a fire. Number three, chicken biryani.
I think that was true.
No, it's false. Are you kidding?
Number it's four. A wacky song, brother.
Number four, an engine.
True.
True. Yes. Number five, cats.
False.
You're right. It's dogs. He smells like dogs, as well as lamb sweat and an engine. Number six, leather.
True.
He smells like leather. She smells like leather, as did his dad. Number seven, coffee.
true.
True, yes. Indeed. Number 8, the Street Fighter character Zangief.
False.
Oh, yeah, I didn't trip up on my, my subtle answer. Number 9, mountains.
True.
It is true, that's correct, yes. Number 10, trees that are warmed by the sun.
True.
No, it's false, it's pebbles that were warmed by the sun.
Oh, that's right.
You
that's
fool.
Right. Yeah.
Number 11, mint.
Always getting those confused. Mint, I'm going to say no.
No, it's true, it smells like mint. Because he likes it in his drink. And sweats. Lamb roasting over fire, but not chicken biryani.
Well, that should have been the clue, because, you know, mint goes with lamb.
Quite. I think I'm more talking about it in drinks, but that's by the way. Number 12, guacamole.
False.
It's true! It smells like guacamole, it's in the song! That's what she smells like.
There were so many things. I know.
I didn't remember them. Number 13, nachos.
False.
It's false. Well done. You didn't slip up on my trick question there. Number 14, mezcal.
True.
It is true. She smells like mezcal. And finally, number 15, regret.
Because it's the child song, I'm going to say false.
It is false. She does not smell of regret. Or if she does, the child can't pick up on it.
No.
So there we go. You did very well.
Thank you. I mean, I did see the film. But the thing is, okay, I understand it's a bit whimsical. It is a song in a musical.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I don't think... Even if I could encapsulate the aroma of our own father, Pandy, I don't think I'd break it down into 15 different composite smells. Especially things that don't smell of anything. You smell of mountains? The fuck does a mountain smell like?
You smell like calculators. You also smell like scotch and sometimes some red wine.
Is that our dad? Okay.
Yeah, that's our dad.
You smell like calculators.
I mean, tell me that's as ridiculous as mountains.
It's in keeping with the film.
I suppose.
So again, that song was hilarious.
It speaks to... I mentioned that I answered my own question earlier about whether the song's added something to it. Because it's a musical, obviously you've got to suspend disbelief because no one would actually be singing this song out loud. I think the songs are there to do what musicals allow songs to do, is to explore emotions of characters in a kind of quirky way, in a sort of soliloquy version, with some kind of poetic language thrown in there as well. And to that extent, it sort of succeeds. Because that's whole song about smelling and stuff, it's outwardly very funny, but it does speak to a certain... way of thinking about your parents or like people that you trust and the smells that are associated with memories,
especially if you've lost them.
Yeah.
And so you cling on to whatever you have. I mean, we're very fortunate that our parents are still alive, but you know, if that were something in your life, I can understand it now.
Indeed.
It being played out. As that song is, you know, a little funny, especially because you'd think that now in the guise of Amelia, that character might want to invest in some fragrances, you know, not to...
Maybe.
Especially if they have what is seemingly a very distinct smell.
Fair enough.
Anyway.
But then there are lots of other songs as well. Okay, and sure. A lot of them are very successful. Some of them are a bit kind of clunky, for want of a better phrase. It's like a very early song where Zoe Saldana's character, she's called Rita. She sings a song about her fat ass and like how she's kind of stuck in life. And it sort of delves into her own thoughts about herself. And then later on, there's a song, Inside the Mind of Amelia, and there's some very clunky lyrics, including the one, and I quote, half kingpin, half queen. And that's something that really kind of irked the trans community and people who are allies of trans people, in terms of like painting trans people as being half and half. And I guess that's kind of what this film is driving towards, because Amelia wants to retain some things from her previous life, but also continue on in her new life. And it kind of explores the quirks and the difficulties associated with that, albeit in this very niche situation where she used to be a crime lord. But the way that it's done is not, it's very clumsy a lot of the time.
Are you aware of the Michelin web sketch of lazy writers?
Yes.
It's like, we didn't do any planning into the hospital. I had a holiday booked. so talk about bad electric and things like that for treating patients. But it does seem, because this is an interesting subject matter, it's a very niche subject matter, so you'd think, so was this done by, or were the people behind it either Mexican or part of the transgender community? No.
Nope.
It was a French guy.
A
directed
French guy.
And written by. Yeah. So
yeah.
It's just like,
and the source material that he wrote as well.
Well, that's what I mean. So it's the case of, I mean, I don't know exactly how much research that he put into it. I'm guessing, based upon the response to the film, the answer is not enough.
Quite.
Or if it were a lot, then as a director, he perhaps didn't showcase the best sides of what he was looking at. Because, I mean, it's not so much, I mean, I say not so much, it's not just the representation of a trans woman. It's also, you know, Mexico at large. Because, you know, who is the lead character? A Mexican drug kingpin. You know, so you've got drug trafficking and all that kind of thing. And
apparently
also,
all of Mexico is complicit in this crime.
Yeah.
Because there is a song later on where they all come forward and go, yes, I let them go and I didn't report them. And it's kind of making Mexico better because Amelia is allowing them to kind of offload themselves of their burdens. Mm. And yikes.
And of the six main characters in the cast, six is generous. They've got the actual surgeon who carries out the surgery is one of them. Of the five major characters, brother, how many of them do you think are Mexican?
Now, let me think. I'm going to estimate 25%.
Of five?
Exactly.
Okay.
Fine. No, I think one of them was.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Remind me which one.
the Amelia's lover. In the second half.
Oh, yes, that's right. Yes. Yeah, I'd forgotten about that. Because Selena Gomez is of.
So she's American.
Yeah, definitely American. Her father is of Mexican descent. Her mother has Italian ancestry. So she's kind of, I don't think she identifies as Mexican at all, but she's got a sort of affiliation with Mexico over some other people.
I mean, she's got some Mexican heritage and her surname is Gomez. So,
yes.
Yeah, I can see it. And, I mean, in fairness to Zoe Saldana, you know, she is of Dominican Puerto Rican stock, although, you know, born and raised American.
Born in the USA!
Sure.
Brian Johnson sang that song.
Carla Sofia Gascon, who was both Emilia Perez and Juan Del Monte, or Manitas, Spanish.
Yeah. So at least spoke the language, but there's a difference between Spanish and Mexican.
There is, yes.
Like 500 miles.
a bit more than that.
I don't do well with distances.
Clearly. but, I mean, speaking of the cast, let's start off with Saldana, because she's not, perhaps, she's not who the film is named after, but hers is the lead role, as she is the through line of the story.
Yes.
So, what did you think? Because, I'll say this now, it's a very different kind of role than the one that I've seen her play before.
Yeah.
To that extent, I found it very interesting to watch her. I thought it was a very engaging performance.
Mm.
She's obviously out of her depth through it. Well, she's kind of put in weird situations as a lawyer, having to do certain things. And then to balance out the drama, there's suddenly singing and dancing. Now,
yeah.
I mean, that's true of Bollywood as well, but this isn't quite the same thing. So, what did you think?
I think you've hit the nail on the head. That, I mean, the character of Rita is very interesting, because she's the through line. So you see her at the beginning of the film being somewhat successful, but ultimately not very happy, and then sort of being tempted by money to go and do something questionable for a questionable person. And then but all the way through, you know that she's a caring person, and you know she's put in various situations, and you get to see her humanity all the way through. And the character itself is one thing, and then it's a very seamless transition from her playing kind of the dramatic persona of Rita, and then entering the sort of subtext world of the songs. And therefore kind of singing the songs, performing them within the context of the emotion of the scene. There's a song, I'd say about halfway through, maybe two thirds of the way through, where she's singing a song at a kind of charity function, and she's kind of being a bit cutthroat and going, me, yes, you will love me, and blah, they all bend over for this situation, I'm great. And it's still demonstrably the same Rita that you saw at the beginning, just having attained a certain status and power and kind of reveling in it, because everything's going great for her and hooray, hooray, hooray. So in terms of her performance, I think she does really well. And I think I'd probably, not to kind of overshadow further discussion about the individual performances, but I'm not sure I could fault a particular performance. I'd say that what you could fault is that these characters are put in very questionable directorial situations, or are given very odd situations, like Selena Gomez having to walk between rooms and do some weird dancing, and then go, I'm so sad, I'm dancing like this, and like, they're doing the best with what they've been told to do, but ultimately they're very odd things that these actors are being asked to do, and they are doing their absolute best to carry things through.
There are some weird choices in the storytelling, I'd say. I'd certainly say that the climax kind of comes out of nowhere.
Yes, it does.
And as you can tell from my happy brother, it's a joyous thing to behold.
Because we all sat there going, oh, so what's going to... Oh, God! Okay! Woo!
Ah, dear. So, what was the point of all that?
Well, basically, yeah. So, what was the cautionary tale here?
What was the moral, exactly?
I'm careful who you help to transition? I don't know. I think the story beat it's trying, or the moral it's trying to put across, is something to do with not being able to have your cake and eat it too, or, you know, when a big thing changes, there are problems that come up with it. I mean, the whole situation is that Emilia wants to, she's decided she's going to transition and leave her old life behind, and that's it.
And that is always portrayed as being very genuine.
Yes, yes, it's never done that.
It's genuine that Manitas always believed that he wasn't born into the correct body. And it's hard for people to swallow, not that he would have been telling many people this, but it obviously goes very much against his persona as a crime boss.
Yeah, and it's also very interesting to have a kind of a trans woman actress.
Yes.
Kind of manning up to play the kind of pre-transition version and then coming back and being a trans woman character. Mm. And you mentioned earlier it's kind of a niche situation. I think it's more that there aren't very many films like this at all.
No.
So it's interesting that it is a kind of standard bearer in many ways, but that's why it's so kind of disappointing that a lot of the story beats or the way things are told are so disappointing, like the line I said earlier, like the fact that when there's an argument earlier on, she kind of defaults to the quote-unquote male voice to kind of show that that's always been inside all along. And, like, it's just a very weird and clumsy storytelling, which kind of lets down what could have been a much more inclusive and well-told story about what happened in this film.
Yeah. What did you think about the acting?
Generally fine. I mean, over the top, very campy in many places. where there were calls to be OTT because of the singing and because it was, like, delving into their psyche. Mm. I think the actors, for the most part, did very well. I think Selena Gomez may have kind of been stretched a bit too far. I can't really fault the performances. It's more the writing, the storytelling, and the directing, and that all falls on the head of Jacques Audiard.
Now, I mean, not before we get to him, just on Gomez. Mm. Notwithstanding the fact that my understanding is she has got some health related issues that means that she can't have children herself. I thought it was a bit of a stretch buying her as a mother of multiple children. Maybe it's just because of her age, or just because she's a young-looking woman. I mean, this film was only made a couple of years ago, but,
yeah.
I mean, even now, I mean, she's 33, so she would have been very early 30s making this. And
you don't see her be very maternal, put it that way.
There's not a lot of scenes between her and the kids.
No, certainly. And mainly the scenes with her and the kids. She's also with, what was his name before the transition? I forgot.
Manitas,
yeah, kind of early on. And then you see them kind of when the old life is gone, just before the time skip, shall we say. You see her kind of being very upset and the kids are there, but she's not really. All of the emotional weight is on her, not the family. And then they kind of move back in and she's definitely very separate to all the action that's going on and is kind of finding her own way, being back in Mexico and going back to her former lover and stuff like that. I agree with you that there's not many opportunities for Selena Gomez's character to be maternal. I'm not sure. Again, I'm not sure that's her fault.
Oh, no, again, I think that's probably more on the storytelling and
yeah.
It's probably a conscious decision to separate her physically on screen from the kids so that, I don't know, to make her a bit more of a more villainous persona when, I mean, there's a redemption arc, certainly, but
just towards the end.
Given the situation she's been placed in by Manitas's choices, it is not incredibly surprising that those certain things pan out the way that they do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I suppose that does tie into the director cum writer, Jacques Audiard. Yeah. I hadn't seen any of his previous stuff before.
Nope.
Possibly because they were in French.
But he's not had any kind of breakout French hits like Amelie was or anything like that. Mm. His biggest, kind of most notable international one will be Emilia Perez. So,
You say that. There was a film called The Sisters Brothers, which starred former featured actor John C. Reilly.
Yes, indeed.
Him, Whacking Bottom.
Ding.
Jake Gyllenhaal.
Hinkinghal.
Riz Ahmed. And...
Oh, nice.
Former Haas subject, Rutger Hauer.
No way.
His final feature film before he died.
Oh. So there you go. We were watching Batman Begins the other day.
Hey.
And they're going, oh, look, it's Rutger Hauer. Hooray.
When you say we... Who are you watching it with?
Oh, I finally got Kel to watch Batman Begins.
Oh, okay.
On my birthday. So what are we doing this evening? Well, I'm going to watch Batman Begins. Oh, I'll watch it with you. Thank goodness for that.
Hey.
She hated Batman Returns so much. She didn't want to watch any of the other films.
So you skipped the Schumacher films.
we skipped the Schumacher ones for better or worse. So definitely for better. And yeah, she really enjoyed it. So now wants to see The Dark Knight with
her.
Yeah. So there we go.
Good stuff.
I mean, yeah, so Jacques Gaudiard is very much responsible, in my view, responsible for a lot of the problems with this film, not all of them. And he's been very much criticized for it. And yeah, I don't know. Do you think there's a way to salvage this film, brother?
I'm just reading his response.
Okay.
Apparently, his initial response was, I didn't study Mexico much. What I needed to know, I already knew a little bit. However, at a press conference in Mexico, he later apologised, acknowledging the concerns.
Okay. What do you mean I need to research Mexico? I'm really sorry, Mexicans.
Yeah.
Fine.
There we go.
Yeah, whatever.
At least he apologised.
And there we go. Mm. Yeah. I mean, it feels like a big old swing and a miss, which is... very disappointing. It's not a kind of a case of it's so bad it's good. I think it's more a case of it's so wacky it bears watching just to see it. So I would recommend it, if not for just the ending. Watch it with somebody else, with a couple of cans, maybe your brother when he comes to visit, and you know, have a gay old time. Watching ultimately.
A lot of people like the film.
I mean, so much so it won an Oscar.
Yes, well, more than one.
Saldana won it.
Yep.
Arguably,
that's why we're covering the film.
That's a good point. And then also one of the songs was a winner as well. It was El Mal, which I referenced earlier, with her dancing around the tables, doing what it describes here as rap rock.
Well, yes.
Well done, her.
Rap rock.
And it's a good performance. I can completely understand it. I don't know what it was up against, and I don't really want to play the Oscar game. it's one of the better songs of the film.
Sure. Cool. Okay.
But I think one last thing I'd think to say is when we kind of championed, brother, the fact that Zoe Saldana is one of the highest, the highest grossing actress or the actress in the most highest grossing thing. This film actively detracted from her numbers. it knocked 10 million off her earnings. her bankable earnings, as it were.
I think it was more a case of you put all the money it made combined rather than how much profit was done. But this film did not make all its money back at the box office. That being said, won plenty of awards and got a lot of attention. And sometimes that's enough.
For better or worse.
Indeed.
Yeah. Do you know, by the way, this was going to be remade with Andrew Garfield. That's
Oh, the old ones are the best.
Yeah, I know, right? So we've covered the three films for lovely Zoe Saldana. Let's go into a little bit more details of her career after this clip.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is your captain speaking. According to our flight plan, we'll arrive tonight.
Hello, very nice to meet you. I'd like to know about sex change operations.
I see. Men to woman, or woman to men.
Man to woman.
From penis to vagina. Is it for you?
For me?
What would you like to know about it, madam?
I want to know it all. What is the protocol? The techniques and the risks. How many operations? How much time do you need?
Mammoplasty.
Yes.
Vaginoplasty.
Yes.
Rhinoplasty.
Yes.
Laryngoplasty.
Yes.
Mammoplasty.
Yes.
Vaginoplasty.
Yes.
Rhinoplasty.
Yes.
Laryngoplasty.
Yes.
Control laryngoplasty.
What is that?
Adam's apple reduction.
Yes, 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 yes.
Vaginoplasty.
Yes.
Adrenoplasty.
Yes. Yes.
Laryngoplasty.
Yes.
Mammoplasty.
Yes.
One piece just for the bath. How much will it be? For you? $4,500.
So, the biggest grossing Hollywood star of all time, Zoe Saldana.
Yeah.
When were you first aware of her being kind of an entity in her own right, or do you remember the first film of hers that you watched?
I do, although not to the extent that I recognised her or knew anything about her. It would be Pirates of the Caribbean.
Indeed, which is a film we watched in America, in an American cinema.
Yes, more than once.
Indeed. Isn't it weird going to the cinema in America?
Yes, it was.
Because they're very vocal.
We did it more often than you'd think. You'd think we'd find other ways to kill time, but seemingly not. But, yeah, we went to see... I mean, I saw a few other films when we were there as well.
Okay.
Because I'm not Claire. Because... Claire, I think I remember going to the cinema three times during that America visit. There was once in San Francisco, where we saw Pirates of the Caribbean. And then there was the IMAX screen in the Luxor.
And we saw The Matrix Reloaded.
We did, yep.
That was amazing.
It was pretty damn good, despite the film.
Yeah.
And then... when we were kind of taking turns as to who was going into Disneyland, the day that you and Mum went, Dad took me and Claire to a cinema, and Claire went to see Pirates of the Caribbean again, I saw Bad Boys 2.
Of course, with Dad?
No, I don't think Dad watched either of them.
Where was Dad then?
Just committing crime, probably.
in LA.
Well, yeah. I don't know. If he did see it, he probably went in with Claire, I guess. But
Sure.
Either way. But then, yeah. Yes,
but they
remember,
clap and that, they cheer.
That particular cinema, when Dad was buying the tickets, the woman behind the counter was doing, "Oh, I just love your accent." Because it was LA, obviously. So,
thank you, lady.
Yes. Well, you know, if we're being technical, it would have been around Anaheim. But not that really matters.
Not really.
Yeah, but with regard to the film, Because her role, it's a supporting one. It's not a major supporting one, but it is relatively important in that she is the captain of the Black Pearl. Or she's the captain of the ship that Jack Sparrow took slash stole or something. She apparently, Saldana had such an unhappy time on the film, she was considering quitting acting.
Really?
Yes.
Gosh.
Because she was aware she was a rather minor player and purported, as I say, not to have been treated particularly well on the film. So that's why you don't see her in the sequels.
Fair enough. She was of all the kind of supporting cast of the people who eventually become the crew of the Black Pearl with Jack Sparrow once again.
Yeah.
She has the highest amount of lines apart from Mr. Tibbs.
Indeed.
And of course, Captain Jack himself. But there we go. So I didn't get to work on her in the sequel games that I worked on. But I'm exactly the same. And it's a good place to start with her filmography, really. Because before that, she had been in Crossroads.
The Britney Spears
Which was billed, as the big kind of Britney Spears first Hollywood film.
Bless
her indeed, yeah. But then the year after Pirates of the Caribbean, The Curse of the Black Pearl, she was in The Terminal, which we covered previously with featured half subjects Tom Hanks, and also with featured half subjects Catherine Zeta-Jones in there as well. Mm-hmm. We've not done Stanley Tucci yet, though.
Not yet.
It'll be interesting one day. Mm-hmm. Anyway, then she was in the next year in a film called Constellation, which was fun on a bun, I would assume. And, you know, I don't know much about it, but it's the kind of highlight from that year.
It was a drama about a black family based around Huntsville, Alabama. And that family includes Gabrielle Union, who we probably know best as being the rival cheerleader in... Bring It On.
Bring It On.
Yep.
Yep. And also in 10 Things I Hate About You.
Indeed. And then Billy Dee Williams, from that there, Star Wars.
Indeed.
And of course. Many more.
Fine. The year after that, she was in a film called Premium, which was kind of a romantic comedy where she was second billed, along with the kind of premium of the film. And then the year after that, she was in a film called After Sex, which is one of these kind of Hollywood anthology films that became quite popular, about pipping between different storylines, kind of like that one we did with Maggie Smith in that hotel. I forget its name.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, it was all about what happens, what they talk about after sex. And I think the breakout couple from there was a Mila Kunis opposite Zoe Saldana.
Ooh.
It was, yes, a lesbian couple in 2007. How very novel. But there we go. And then the year after that, she was in a film which I've seen, I'm not sure if you've seen, brother, called Vantage Point.
I have not.
Which was revolutionary at the time because it was all about what you could see from various angles, and this person, what they saw, might not actually be what actually happened. Because then you look at the same story from somebody else's point of view. Ooh, it's a rewind in time, fun time drama film with What's-His-Face from Lost, who didn't really amount to much. Matthew Fox.
Oh, right. Because there are allegations about Matthew Fox.
Are there really? Oh, that's not funny. So let's quickly move on to Forrest Whitaker.
His Hobbit co-star.
Oh, no, really?
I think Dominic Monaghan. Is that his name?
Yeah.
Well, either Merry or Pippin.
Fine.
Basically,
when they worked in Lost.
Yes, they had a big to-do. So,
Fun. Fun and parody. And then the year after that is when things really started to kick up a notch. Because in 2009, she was the reimagined Uhura from the re-release Star Trek film, yes, which again is a kind of re-release back in time. Look at them, they're all young and stuff, but also it's the same people, kind of, sort of, not really. Did you watch Star Trek?
I've seen bits and pieces, but because I was never really a Trek person, and then it being J.J. Abrams put me off. I don't rate him whatsoever.
Sure.
And then I hear all this thing about there being like lens flare throughout the film.
There was quite a lot of lens flare, actually.
So I gave it a miss, ultimately.
I mean, I watched it and enjoyed it, and I didn't mind not knowing anything about Star Trek. I'm sure we'll hear more about this when we have the Orcs feedback.
Almost certainly, yes.
But, okay, from my point of view, because I came into watching Star Trek having not knowing much about Star Trek, obviously knowing the characters and the general themes and stuff, and the big rubber monsters that What's-His-Face would fight.
Shatner.
I didn't mind it. Shatner, thank you. It would kind of come back to a reimagined storyline, different world, different people, sort of, in a very different form to the TV show, but still paying homage to the TV show. So it'd be interesting to hear how a purist would take that and beyond.
Yep.
And then, of course, you did come back for the sequels.
Yes.
There you go. The same year of that, we had the previously aforementioned Avatar.
Yes.
Great, big, massive film. With lots of sequels, which she was in all of so far. Then in 2010, she was in a little film which we may talk about a little bit next month, brother, when we discuss Peter Dinklage.
Yeah.
She was in the reimagined black comedy version of Death at a Funeral.
That is correct, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there was an original UK version of the film some 3-4 years prior, as directed by Frank Oz. And in the way that a lot of like foreign horror films get US remakes, they decided that a very English farce needed a US remake.
Right.
So, yes, there'll be a fair amount of cast comparisons and such like next month, but as I said, that's for the next episode. Also that
the same year.
Yeah.
Oh, I was going to say, are you going to talk about The Losers?
Yes, briefly.
Yeah. So she was in a film called The Losers, which is a comic book adaptation, so would have been eligible for your comic relief segment.
It was covered in comic relief, yes.
Oh, well, there you go. With some big names. Chris Evans in 2010. This would be just before Captain America.
It was, yeah.
Would it be just after Fantastic Four or around the same time?
So it's in his wilderness years in between.
Got you. Okay. And also Sir Idris Elba.
Yes.
Hell yeah. I mean, he wasn't Sir at the time, but there you go. He's now. He'll be interesting to cover one day. Mm-hmm. I have a character in my D&D sessions that I've based on Idris Elba.
Okay.
He's an orc called Chief Bolgo, which is directly referencing his character in Zootopia, or Zootropolis.
Okay.
So I just put on his voice and go very, very angry. And yeah, that's how it happens. I like D&D. It's a lot of fun.
Also,
but yeah, she was in that.
Also, and Jeffrey Dean Morgan.
Jeffrey Dean Morgan, the guy who was the comedian in The Watchmen.
Yes.
Yeah. Ha 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 ha. Good. Excuse me. I am a professional. She had some fairly small hits in 2011 and 12, respectively, being now the kind of main protagonist or the main character, the main actor in the Columbiana and the Words in 2011 and 12, respectively, before reprising Uhura in 2013 into the Star Trek Into the Darkness, which brings in Benedict Cumberbatch as Khan!
Yes.
Spoilers.
And people hate it.
Fine. And in the same year as that, she's in a film called Out of the Furnace, starring alongside Christian Bale, Woody Harrelson, one of the Afflecks, but not that one, oh dear, Forrest Whitaker, Willem Dafoe, and Sam Shepard.
Ooh.
Into the big leagues now.
Sure.
Cool. Thank you for your input. 2014, her stardom ascends even further as she joins the MCU as Gamora in Guardians of the Galaxy. What do you take on her performance in that? Obviously, it kind of evolved from this first film into being something very important to the franchise as a whole.
Yes. I loved Guardians of the Galaxy then. Still very fond of it now.
Have you seen all of them?
No. I've not seen the third one.
Neither have I.
I've only seen the second one once or twice. I've certainly seen it once, but I don't know how many times I've rewatched it. The role of Gamora calls for her to be, you know, the kind of straight woman to the antics of pretty much the rest of the main cast, whilst being very capable and of herself. And whilst you don't see it to the fullest extent in this particular film, obviously her relationship with Nebula plays through the MCU quite prominently. She's very good as Gamora.
And showing off some action chops again.
Indeed.
With some fighting and stuff. And in the same year, she lent her voice to a film that the kids really like called The Book of Life, which is a kind of retelling of a Mexican story, which is fun, and their kids like it. So there we go. I thought I'd mention it. She was in a film called Unity in 2015. Not really much to say about that one.
Going through everybody's bloody film in their filmography.
I would like to remind you, I just said we're not going to talk about that one, because we're going to talk about 2016, where she came back to the Star Trek franchise once again. Also Nina, what a shame, never mind. And in a film called Live by Night, which was directed and written by the other Affleck, with slightly less problems, but also with Chris Cooper, Elle Fanning and Brendan Gleeson.
I didn't know Casey Affleck had problems. But there we go.
Really? Oh, well.
Well, just because I don't care. But I'll look into it. But keep going.
Fair enough. 2017, Guardians of the Galaxy again, and a film called I Kill Giants, which looks pretty interesting. And then the My Little Pony movie, which, again, the kids quite like. And then she's gone to two different Avengers films in 2018-19, where she reprises her role as Gamora in Big Time Staley. To high acclaim, and it's a very big kind of dramatic point of the entire film. Ooh. And then a bit of a backseat for a couple of years before returning for The Adam Project, starring Ryan Reynolds. I'm meant to call him Deadpool just because he's so synonymous with that world now, or that character now, otherwise known as the owner of Disney FC, Wrexham. And, of course, coming back for the second Avatar film after the great big lengthy hiatus from 2009. She was then, in 2023, here's three films to go next to each other. Guardians of the Galaxy 3, which we've not seen, so won't talk about. Absence of Eden, which is something that is not to high acclaim. But something that is to even less acclaim is Good Burger 2.
Yeah. The long-awaited sequel to the 1997 kids' movie Good Burger.
And the Nickelodeon TV series of the same name.
Well, there was a TV series specific.
Oh, no, so it was Kenan and Kel,
but it
sorry.
Was Kenan and Kel, yeah.
Yes.
Kenan Thompson, who has had a record-breaking multi-year stint on Saturday Night Live, and Kel...
Who is also there.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, sure. We covered Emilia Perez, which was out in 2024. She was in the two very animated films in 2025. The unfortunately ill-fated Elio, which is possibly one of Pixar's biggest flops.
Heard of Elio. What's it about?
That's possibly why it was a flop.
Yes.
It's about a boy who really, really wants to be abducted by aliens. I think the kids saw it at school.
Right.
But it didn't really, set the world on fire. And I don't know to what end her voice is in it. Olga Solaris is the name of the voice.
Sure.
There we go. And then back for Avatar Fire and Ash. And then this year she was executive producer in a film called The Bluff for Amazon. Otherwise, nothing yet. So we've seen kind of similar trajectories in terms of like early roles and then bow, great big roles. I think the thing that really sets her apart from other actors we've covered is the amount of blockbuster hits kind of concentrated in the mid-teens and early 20s.
Yeah.
Well, not even the early 20s. The mid to late teens of the 21st century, which has garnered her the massive box office takings that she... Well, that kind of predicated us doing this episode, really.
Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. She's worthy of covering in her own rights. But the very fact that she, of all people, is the person who can credibly say... I am the most bankable, is an interesting one. Now, in fairness, it's because she's been in the ensemble cast of a lot of these things. It's not necessarily that she is a box office draw in and of herself, and I don't wish to use that as a criticism.
No.
It is more the case that she has chosen her projects wisely if she wants to be best known as, you know, a major actress associated with big films. It's not necessarily the fact that she's going to be called upon to deliver, you know, an acting tour de force. Because I suppose what she was going for with Nina would be the closest you'd think of with regard to that. And again, it does sound a bit unfair in that she has won an Academy Award for her acting, in Emilia Perez. Now,
yeah.
To what extent that is deserved, the wrong word. I mean, thinking back on Perez, I mean, bear in mind, you've literally just heard the review of it. you know, she does have a lot to do, don't get me wrong, but it wasn't a case of me being blown away by her acting performance necessarily. It's whether or not it was the best acting performance of that year, I don't know. But the Academy says yes. So, I mean, they say yes on lots of things, but... you know, it was a very successful film that year. So
it was, but it falls into the trend of it's not Zoe Saldana as the star. She is like she's highly ranked among the cast, but I think the only film that we've covered today where she is the star is Nina. Obviously, it's a sad indication of that being the only one. But a lot of the films that she has kind of become so kind of bankable, she is not the main star. She is like the very highly rated support, whether it's Neytiri in the Avatar films or Gamora in the Guardians of the Galaxy films or Uhura, who's kind of even further back in the pecking line because obviously you've got Spock and Kirk in front of them. So she's not somebody or she's not an actress that... I mean, certainly in terms of the films we've covered, has on her own carried these films across the line, but that's not to do down her performances within those films.
No. We should also quickly give a nod over to her television work.
Okay.
She had the main role in a TV adaptation of the classic Roman Polanski horror film Rosemary's Baby in 2014. Okay. In which she played the titular Rosemary. And then she's been in the very high-profile Paramount Plus show Lioness since 2023.
Okay. I've not heard of it.
Oh, right, no. So it's a fairly prominent TV series where a group of... a CIA team enlists female field operatives to take down terror threats, and so
okay.
Zoe Saldana is the main person in that.
Is it good?
Don't know. I've never seen it.
Oh, fine.
Yeah. But it
oh, that's what Morgan Freeman is doing nowadays. Yeah. Oh.
It's quite prominent.
Okay. Well, I feel out the loop now. Mm. Shall we hear some feedback about what other people think about lovely Zoe Saldana?
By all means, yes.
Okay. What should we start with?
We have a written piece of feedback and an MP3. Let's go with the written first.
And, okay.
The written feedback. Three guesses. That's right. It's Christian.
Hooray! Constant feedback. We love it. So consistent feedback. Not constant feedback. That sounds like I'm needling him.
Christian writes, hello, IJW and AJW.
Yes, acronyms. Initials.
That's the one.
I can't think of words today. I've heard the word Christian and my mind's gone blank.
Well, you did it, you crazy SOBs. Parentheses, sons of Britain. You did it. For this episode, you have not one, not two, but three instant candidates for the worst film covered in 2026 for the next round of the Tomlinson Awards.
Oh my, oh my.
I don't have anything against Zoe Saldana as an actress, or even your choices for the episode, but by Jupiter, it had to be said. I've not subjected myself to either Nina or Amelia Perez, and even if I had, I probably wouldn't have had much interesting to contribute feedback-wise as a palish, male, cisgender, non-Mexican. Like Pandy and now Ian, however, I have seen Avatar, this time not in 3D, in IMAX, or any kind of big screen, and with adult eyes and higher standards. Without any further pomp and circumstance, I offer the following random observations and opinions. This film is just like Pocahontas, except if John Smith were a white saviour figure, and if he and Pocahontas had sex beneath Grandmother Willow. Classic.
Listen with your heart. Oh my god.
Point number two. For a film that purports to sympathise with the plight of indigenous peoples, both imagined and real, the Na'vi sure do embody a lot of stereotypes associated with Native Americans, especially with their clothing and war cries. At least they don't sing to Jake Sully about what made the blue man blue.
Thank goodness.
That's a very deep joke, that one. Point number three. Getting to Zoe Saldana. I don't have a problem with her vocal or physical performance in the film. Unlike a digitised Andy Serkis performance, however, where you can always feel the nuances and humanity of the actor even when he's playing a shrunken, half-mad cave hobbit or a giant, battle-scarred gorilla, I feel like the design and realisation of Na'vi overshadows and dilutes her and the other Na'vi actors' performances, making them feel more like cartoon characters than anything resembling live-action ones.
There is a bit of a blurring of the line, especially having watched the sequels now in high def and how they do a lot better of kind of merging the kind of, for want of a better phrase, the cartoony side of things with the kind of blurring the human or the real with the animated stuff in a way that looks believable. That's definitely got that better in the sequel films than they did in the original, where yeah, there was a bit of a lot of uncanny valley of like, is this an animated film, is this a live action film? I can take that one.
Point number four. On this viewing, my least favorite character was neither the gormless milquetoast hero, nor the greedy capitalist, nor the cookie-cutter army bad guy, but Sigourney Weaver's super-patronising and, frankly, ableist head scientist. She's like Julianne Moore's character in The Lost World, but twice as annoying and far more problematic.
Huh.
Each to their own. Five. This may be the case of me missing the forest for the trees, but did it seem like none of the human clothes or fashions feel that they were futuristic and all of them came from the late 20th or early 21st century rather than the mid 22nd?
What?
Costuming. Do you not think it was too futuristic? Or, no. Yeah.
What, in Avatar?
Yes.
It
wasn't futuristic enough. It was a bit too much like what people would wear nowadays.
I'd never even thought of that as a thing, really. It didn't seem to bother me too much, but fair enough.
I think it would be fair to say that the human aspect is the aspect of the Avatar movies that least appeals to James Cameron. So,
yeah,
he probably... I mean, it's a stretch to say he wouldn't care, but he wouldn't care as much as he cares about the finishing touches of the Na'vi and how Pandora looks.
Yeah, well, like, they're humans, you know what they're like, you know these people. I guess it might detract from the film to kind of have them wearing futuristic polo shirts. Yeah. Like, you know, like in Futurama, where all the armbands have got, like, extra little spikes on them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Point number six, there are seven, so penultimate point. If I have to give this film one thing, it would be that it has some neatly designed wild animals inhabiting Pandora. That said, I couldn't help but notice that the big black panther one had a few roars that were near identical to those of the T-Rexes in the Jurassic Park films. Similarly,
and he would know, wouldn't he? Would.
Similarly, the Na'vi horse's snorts came straight from those films' velociraptors. Thankfully, this film didn't win any Sandra Bullock awards. For thieving, seemingly. Mm. Final point. To sum up, the huge film negligible pop culture impact, and to paraphrase a pivotal, if problematic, PM, never in the field of Western cinema was so much spent by so many to so little effect.
Wow.
There are other criticisms or observations I could mention as well, like how most directors shouldn't be allowed to write their own scripts and how uninspired a lot of James Horner's score for the film is, parts of which feel recycled from Star Trek III and The Land Before Time, which he also scored 2 decades earlier, but I'll stop here. Looking forward to hearing how each of you took this cliched, bloated and maddening injustice of a film, as well,
good Lord.
As well as the one with the colorism and the one about Mexico made by French people. Yours faithfully and enigmatically, CSH. P.S. I hope Werner Herzog gets to one day meet and converse with Vincent Price.
Well, let's just see. Oh, who's that at the door? Hello, it is me, Werner Herzog, and I am here to discuss with my brand new friend, Vincent, and here he is now. Yes, I am here, and I am happy to talk to you, Werner. That is good to know. What did you think of Avatar?
Well, I've been dead for quite a long time, so it's difficult for me to say, because I'm not sure what these cat people are, but I think there maybe are some redeeming features to Avatar, don't you agree?
There is no redeeming features to anything. We are all scum. We are all worms. Scrawling around the Pandora of our own making. Gosh, what a pretentious thing to say. Goodbye now. Yes, I think this joke has run its course.
Wow.
So there you go. That's me responding to Chris. Yeah. In character twice.
That is some improv forever.
Well... Again, D&D, love it. And one of the big bads was inspired by Werner Herzog. Oh, right. But there we go. But you know, I think, yeah, not yet. I'll write that into my notes. Mm. But yeah, I think you're absolutely right. There are some valid criticisms. There are lots of valid criticisms to Avatar. But I think it's a kind of spectacle movie that, I mean, you hit the nail on the head that I watched it with objective eyes. With kind of grown-up eyes, not in a cinema with 3D and IMAX and blah, blah, blah. On its own, it's kind of a, yeah, that's a thing. Good. I think it's not, like, objectively awful, or it has more kind of good bits than bad, whereas Emilia Perez is more kind of, what? Yeah, so I can understand the criticism, but I don't feel it as strongly as Christian does, I would say.
Sure. Okay, well, we have one more piece of feedback, and it is some audio feedback from the Vicarage of Org. I do wonder, brother, if they've got any Star Trek opinions, say. But having not listened to this in advance, let's hear what they've got to say now.
Indeed, let's do it.
Hello, Brothers Wilson.
Hello.
We're giving our views on Zoe Saldana's. we know her best from
Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah, it's an awesome film. I went to see that, was it three times at the cinema, which is pretty impressive.
Yeah, one of the times I wanted to go, so I don't think I got to see it in the cinema at all. And one of the times you were going, I had to go and see some gobshite with the kids.
Oh, tragiques. I bet it was Minions or something.
I don't know. I just remember wanting to be in the same screening you were in.
Yeah.
And I had to go and watch whatever it was. I think it might have even been a fucking SpongeBob.
Who knows? And she's good in Volume 2 as well. I've only seen Volume 3 once. Got no great desire to watch that again. She may have been all right in it, I can't remember. But of course, she's a lot in the Avengers films as well, and quite a big role in that. So, yeah, she's good in that. She looks good in green.
Yep.
She no idea if she looks good in blue or not.
No.
In Avatars, because when it first came out, I was like, no, I'm not going to see some 3D film now. I'm not going. And eventually loads of people said, well, you know, it's an experience and you have to go and see it in 3D. I was like, oh, okay then. So I bought a ticket and it snowed and I couldn't get to the cinema. And I saw that as an active girl. So I have not seen it and I'm now not going to see it either because apparently the universe will end or something. I don't know. But if it were all I know, she might be very good in it. We also, sadly, you know her from Star Trek 09. I mean, it's not her fault she's in those films. Well, it is. It's her agent's fault or something. I don't know. Absolutely travesty. I hated that from day one. Ugh, don't.
You did. I don't mind it. I think...
Star Trek.
It's the better of the
it
three.
It is definitely the best of the three, yes, but it's still not great. It's got that massive space station. It's just stupid. Yeah. Yes.
I quite like Beyond, to be honest. And she's all right in it as Uhura, but she's no... is it Celia Rose Gooding who plays her in...
Yes, in Strangely Worlds. I much prefer her. I mean, she gets more to do, to be fair, and is more interesting. Whereas in the... Trek reboot films, she's pretty much just a love interest, really. So, yeah. And what else did I watch? Oh, yes, I watched Emilio Perez. At least I started watching Emilio Perez because that's one of the three films they're covering.
Okay.
It started with auto-tune singing, which immediately put my back up.
Ooh.
And then the crowd started randomly singing, and I realised, it's a stealth musical. No! I checked straight out. She may have been amazing in it. I mean, the first 5 minutes she was fine in it. It was just the singing. No.
Oh.
and we saw her in Terminal as well, but I watched that ages ago for this very podcast, and I've not seen it since. So I can't remember whether she's amazingly good or not. I mean, what I've seen her in, she's been fine. Hardly a glowing reference, I guess, but she's all right. She isn't somebody I'd go, ooh, Zoe Saldana's in that. I must go and sit.
No, because she's been in some shit. I have seen the first half an hour of The Adam Project.
Yeah. Who knows?
That's half an hour. I'm not getting back because she's in that.
Okay, what's that about?
It's a supposedly superhero, bollocky, gobshite thing that I wish never existed.
Okay, well, that's concise, if not very descriptive.
Oh, it was just trying to be superhero-y, trying to be Indiana Jones-y.
You thought she'd had enough of superheroes in the old Avengers. I mean,
yeah,
blimey.
It's a sort of superhero-y, mutants, Indiana Jones, doesn't really know what it is, and it's just shit. And I got very cross with it. And I started watching it, I think because it was just on one of the streaming things, and I was looking for something to watch. And it was just like, you know what? Playing even more Candy Crush on my phone for an hour and a half is better than this.
So not a glowing reference. Okay.
No. So, you know, she might be good in it, but she... I'm not going to go Zoe Saldana's in it, because that's technically how you pronounce it, because it's got one of them tildes over the N.
Ooh.
Because she's Latin American.
Ah.
So it's Saldana. But, yeah, I'm not going to go, oh, Zoe Saldana's in it, I'm going to watch it, because I know that she's been in some shit. There's got to be something else. Do you know what I mean? That makes me think, oh, right, I'll watch that then.
Well, if nothing else, I've learnt how to pronounce Zoe Saldana's name anyway, so... this has not been a waste of time.
Fair enough.
I hope you got more joy out of the films than we did. Take care. Cheerio, bye.
Bye-bye.
Oh, what fun. Jesus. I mean, I knew they'd have strong feelings about Star Trek, but good to know that they hate other things as well.
Yes.
And that God himself warns the vicar to not go and watch the film. So, you know.
I mean, Peter would be on... A bit closer to the inner circle of God than the rest of us. So, yeah.
Remember that bit in The Simpsons where something goes wrong for Ned Flanders and he goes, thanks, God, or stops it from happening, yeah. And then it comes down, oh, Oakley Doakley. I like to think that's kind of what happens in a weather way.
Yeah, exactly how it happens. Excellent. Okay, well, thank you very much, Orgs, for the audio feedback and indeed, Christian, for the written feedback. You too can send in feedback by sending an email with an email or an MP3 attached to it to hey@earth-2.net. That's hey@earth-2.net. We also have a Facebook page and you can put things there. Whether or not they make the show, I've got no idea.
I don't use Facebook personally anymore. I don't even open the app to look at if anything's happened for us anymore. Just because, you know, Zuckerberg's a wrong'un.
True.
And ultimately, these tech bros are going to be the end of humanity. So, hey, why don't you email us? Email a forum. why ever not?
We
should get a P.O. box. That would be fun.
For one, welcome our new race of Bond villains because it makes them more obvious to foil.
I mean, now that Amazon owns the Bond franchise, it'd be interesting to see what
delicious
villains
irony,
they come up with nowadays.
Yes.
Yeah.
But there we go. Okay, then, brother. Mm. So, next on the docket is that actor, Peter Dinklage.
Dinkles, winkles, let's talk about the wank... No, what? Peter Dinklage! Yeah! I mean, we've got some films to talk about with him. And do you want to go first? It's your turn to start the episode. So, brother, what have you picked out for me to watch for Peter Dinklage?
Well, for you, brother, I have gone with a film which is an ensemble. I'll just say it now. It's an ensemble. But...
Sure.
He has a prominent, pivotal role in both versions of the film. That's right.
Wait a minute.
That's right. It's the aforementioned Death at a Funeral. That being said, not the US version. We are going to cover the British version. Because of...
I can't believe you'd said that.
Of course we are. And don't worry, Americans... There are Americans in it, like Peter Dinklage and Alan Tudyk.
hooray!
And it's directed by Frank Oz as well, so he's...
Waka waka!
I mean, actually, technically, Frank Oz was born in the UK, but...
Can we claim him?
Yes, let's do that.
Hooray!
You'll be watching Death at a Funeral for the first time, but it'll be my homework that kicks things off, brother. So what are we going to start the episode with?
We'll be starting the episode, because I got the format wrong, my bad, with another situation where there's a stage adaptation... a film adaptation of a stage musical.
Yeah.
And this is going to be him as Cyrano... As in Cyrano de Bergerac.
I see.
Which will be fun on a bun to discuss.
Yeah. Especially if you've seen lots of versions of Cyrano de Bergerac before.
I mean, you know me. I'm on crack for that Bergerac. I don't know what that means.
I'm on crack for that
I'm
Bergerac.
Psycho for Cyrano.
Okay. Lovely stuff.
I also enjoy the film? Anyway, let's talk about something else. And then we'll finish the episode with the joint project, that being his turn as the Toxic Avenger in the film The Toxic Avenger.
Yeah. That's going to be interesting, because that's going to be a horror comedy. And we haven't looked at much by the way of, well, certainly horror recently.
Mm.
It's a remake, so we can go into All That Is Trauma.
Hooray.
If you aren't listening.
I don't know what that means.
It's a film studio.
Okay.
Yes. As covered on WHXN Midnight Movie Club. So.
Oh, of course. I have listened to a few episodes of that.
Yes.
Not for a while, though. Sorry.
They closed off the most recent season with a look at three trauma-backed films, which include, brother, Cannibal the Musical.
Oh,
they were the studio.
The
who
sky
that
is
out.
Blue, and now the leaves are green.
That's all.
My heart's as full as a baked potato. Oh, cool.
Mm.
I might have to listen to that one. Great. So we've got those films picked for next time. It'll be Cyrano de Bergerac, or Cyrano, followed by Death at a Funeral from 2007, and finishing with The Toxic Avenger.
Yes.
And of course, we'll talk about some of his other work, because I have seen Game of Thrones, whereas you have not.
Great.
He has been in the MCU and other things as well. So we'll have a chat about him, as we always do. Hooray, hurrah. Which leaves one last thing to decide, which is the person that we'll be covering on the episode after.
Yes.
The wonderful Peter Dinklage. And it's my turn to pick.
Carefully not mentioning any months, but yes, go on.
So I have picked this time, brother, the Tomlin Award-winning actor that we need to cover this year, that being the fabulous Patrick Stewart.
Ah.
My brother in boldness.
Yes, that's what he's known for.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right, so Sir Patrick Stewart.
Indeed.
Long time coming, having featured his great pal Sir Ian McKellen many years prior.
Indeed.
So, get in your suggestions for Patrick Stewart. We'll take under advisement X-Men films, notwithstanding the general rule about comic book movies. And, you know, I dare say a Star Trek film is probably on the docket, but we'll see. We'll see. We're looking for all suggestions, So,
indeed. We need your input. So let us know via the forums, the Facebook page, or our email address, which once again is hey@earth-2.net.
That's the one. Well, brother. Yeah. Yes. Another episode done and dusted. And
absolutely.
We head forward into the rest of 2026.
Indeed. Well, it feels like this year is flying by
with
all the episodes
it?
We've been doing.
With all the episodes we've been doing. Yes.
Yeah. So have a wonderful summer, and we'll talk to you next time. Have a wonderful time. Look after yourselves.
Yeah, have a lovely
Good luck to... yes. Happy Burns night. And yeah, fingers crossed that by the next time we record, we're able to say that it came home. It's coming home. It's coming home. It's probably not, but you know. Anyway, bye everybody.
Bye.
Big love. Juez, santos, mírenlo, no le importa nada. Solo los niños, los narcos, los ratanaderos los llevan afuera de todos sus pueblos natales. A cambio de eso, Santos reduce los juicios a falta de pruebas. Habla, esta gente habla, pero ahora lo van a pagar, a pagar, a pagar. Habla, esta gente habla, pero lo van a pagar, lo van a pagar. Los conoce, a mí nadie, o solo un poco. Soy Emilia Pérez, una mujer mexicana, una mujer como las demás. Miren al secretario de Educación, dizque pública, especialista en las
las empresas fantasmas. Hoy sus contratos sí, sí son reales, pero las escuelas no se construyen ahora. Cuéntanos, Chucho, ¿de dónde sacaste tu jet, tu alberca, tu hotel? Miren el gobernador, ¿quién votó por él? La gente o el cártel, hay que compró. Ay, sí, uno a uno los votos de los campesinos. Paga, págale al cártel bombón. Ya están sentados en tu pinche trono. Habla esta gente, habla, pero ahora lo van a pagar, a pagar, a pagar. Habla esta gente, habla, pero ahora lo van a pagar, lo van a pagar.
Pero gracias a Dios, tengo a mi lado a una mujer excepcional, a Rita Mora Castro. Ella es la inteligencia andando, la inteligencia andando. Es muy difícil.
Dicen al cojo, no eres cojo de nacimiento. En tu próximo puto retraso de pago acabarás en la silla de rueda, lo sabe. Bien, el que perdió su mano, sé muy puntual si eres corrupto. Miren al querido Gabriel Mendoza, a con su nueva mujer, su nueva esposa, muy joven, muy rubia, rubia. Habla, esta gente habla, pero ahora lo van a pagar, a pagar, a pagar. Habla, esta gente habla, pero ahora lo van a pagar, lo van a pagar.
Perder a un ser amado es una tragedia, pero de sus restos es una condena, es una condena, es una condena.
Yes, next. Let's move on to our next film for this episode, brother.
Mm.
That being, I've forgotten. What's the order?
Avatar.
That being our main event.
Nope.
That being the biggest film that we've covered ever on this podcast, the 2008 film Avatar.
2009.
The 2009 film Start Avatar. Fuck you. Okay. The main event for this episode. And the... No, fuck! Our second film today, the largest film that we've ever covered on this podcast, 2009's Avatar.
Lovely stuff.
Well, do it live! Fucking thing sucks!
Thanks, Bill.
Yeah. I'm gonna stop.